at 1:55, I'll make a motion to, no, I'll...
Open the meeting.
Open the meeting.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you.
All right.
I should do a roll call, an official roll call.
Okay, roll call, please.
Conklin?
Here.
Crunch?
Here.
Needhammer?
Here.
Page?
Here.
Solomon?
Here.
Quorum present.
Mike, you want to make the introductions?
Yeah, sure. Well, we're very fortunate, I believe, to have Caroline Kennedy, who's the village clerk with the city of, the village of Elk Rapids.
Assistant village manager.
And what else you got?
Not my favorite role there.
So she's got her hands in local government, so she sees it from our perspective. She also has the background of working for the Michigan Municipal League for a number of years, kind of as their Northern Michigan representative, so she'd always be at various activities that were going on in Northern Michigan. And actually, I forget what year it was that you came and actually did one of these orientations for the city commission in her role with the Michigan Municipal League.
A couple times, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a couple times. Yeah.
So, and we haven't done one for a while. Hugh and I were talking just the other day, since he got elected to the city commission, he's been trying to get to one of the league's conferences. He was scheduled to go to the one in Cadillac, and every time he tries to go, they have a major snowstorm.
And it was snowy this morning. I don't know what.
Yeah, I got snowed out twice.
Uh-huh. Well, it was twice the last time, wasn't it? Once this year? I thought it was three times altogether.
No, just twice.
Well, I thought you tried it twice before.
No.
Okay.
No, just
right.
Twice.
Or I was adding to the lore. So anyway, so Caroline comes to this with a whole wealth of experience to bring with us. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Caroline.
Yeah, I actually was with the league for 17 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Three of that, I used to lobby in the Capitol. That's where I came from. I actually worked for the Michigan State Senate for 10 years before I went to the league. And I actually started my career with a political consulting firm before I went to the Senate, and then lobbied, and then I took the position as the field representative for the league. So I had 104 communities. 41 in the UP, including the island, and 63 down here. So lots and lots of driving.
You did all that.
Went through a lot of cars.
You did all that in 30 years.
Yeah, I'd have to add it all up, but it's been a while, for sure. And like Mike said, now I'm with the Village of Elk Rapids. I'm really happy there. I really enjoy it. So yeah, it's been a nice, well-rounded experience.
And you were in the private sector there for a while between the league and the village, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I was working for an association. Yeah. But it's not as good a fit. This is a much better fit. I really enjoy what I'm doing now.
So, what do you do as an assistant city manager?
I managed to pull in quite a few grants recently, so I'm pretty happy with that. Uh-huh. I spent quite a bit of time doing that. I train our council. I do the clerk functions as well. I'm the FOIA coordinator. I do a lot. Actually, I work on a lot of projects that we've got going.
How big is the village?
1642. Right. Yeah. So and we lose a lot of those people in the winter. Our base is about 600.
All right. Wow, really?
Causes us some challenges.
How big is the school?
I can't tell you that right off the top of my head.
Because they're in our conference, aren't they? And they're Class B, so really, outside of your village limits, you have a population that's, mm-hmm. And that's kind of like Gaylord is almost the same size as us, but they're a Class A school, so outside of the city limits is where the population is living, is what I'm assuming.
Yeah, our population is actually a little bit higher than Galen, but you never know it.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so I had an agenda ready for you, but Mike and I have mixed it up, so I don't have an agenda for you anymore. We're going to start with local government basics and understanding the council manager form of government. Kind of two presentations mashed into one. I should explain that what you're getting today, I used to call it the crash course. because it actually takes four presentations that you would normally attend for 3 hours each, and I smash them all into one 3-hour course, and then I throw in like three exercises as well. So we have a lot of work to do. We like to move pretty quickly. If I'm covering stuff you just don't have an interest in or don't care about, you're not going to hurt my feelings. I'll be happy to move on. You can just say so. We kind of put a lot in here because everybody comes from a different background. I mean, when was the last time anybody had civics class, you know?
And paid attention.
Or local history. I mean, you know, local government.
Do they still even teach those in classes anymore?
Yeah, you know, I don't think they do. Every once in a while, my kids will come to me and say, Mom, I think I've got to do something that you could probably help with. Usually, they're like, yeah, you can't help.
They must. We should have kids at this.
So, we'll start with, I will start with this. I'll give you a little commercial for the league. I'm not doing this for the league, but, you know, I had a wonderful time there, and I really think highly of that organization. So, if and when you get the time to attend their trainings or their convention, you know, please do. They do some really wonderful things with mobile workshops where you get to get out in the other communities and ask questions about their projects and how they pulled it together. And it's pretty invaluable, I think.
I think we're hoping that we'll have a good turnout to go for the Capital Conference. And when is that?
Well,
February, March?
And that's key too, because a lot of communities don't pay attention to the legislation that's going on. It has, you know, hasn't been very friendly towards local government in many ways. So it's important to talk to your legislators. You know, the 3 years that I lobbied there, they have to have cover. Your legislators have to have cover with their party leaders. They have to be, you know, because they're expected to toe the party line and do what we're going to do here. And unless they can go in and say, boy, I heard from Boyne City and East Jordan and Village of Elk Rapids, and, you know, they're going to have my head if I do this, I can't do it. If they don't hear from you, they're going to, you know, go along with the party line because that's how they have leverage later when they need it. So it is important to keep on top of that stuff and to make those phone calls. And they listen to the managers, but they always like to hear from the elected officials, I think, legislators.
Could I jump off on that just
for
a sec?
Yeah, absolutely.
You may recall that the state's looking at restoring the historic tax credits. Mm-hmm. And there was some legislation and going with regards to that, and they had a hearing on that recently. And I contacted Wayne Schmidt, our legislator, to let them know that we were supportive of it and we were hearing things were going in a positive direction. And he wanted to make sure that we reached out to the league's representative who was going to be able to go to that session. And we wanted to make sure that that person could get up and say, the city of Boyne City is in support of this, to give Wayne exactly the cover you're talking about type of thing.
Right. At any time that I send a letter to our state representative or our state senator, I send a copy to the league, to whoever's working on that issue, so that they have some ammunition to say.
And just for all the commissioners, a reminder for some and new information for you folks, we have I'm appointed by the city commission as your legislative coordinator. Mm-hmm. So if when you're seeing emails from me asking about, okay, do you want us to take a position on legislation or something like that, or here's what I'm planning to do unless you tell me otherwise, I'm kind of doing my role of that. I'm supposed to kind of watch the legislation, report to the commission, and then kind of be your voice for it as well, too.
So, you know, along those lines, there's other forms of making commentary about issues and so on. And one way is to write a letter.
Yep.
That we would say, go ahead and write a letter, but that's not really an official action we're voting on, right?
Correct.
And then there's like a resolution of something. And how do those of support for this or that or against this or that, and how do those, you know, differ? When do we want to do one over the other?
From my time in the legislature, I mean, everything just moves so fast.
Yeah.
Well, it can sit for through, you know, a year and a half and then move fast. So it doesn't really matter. They just need to hear. You know, it's nice if you send a letter and you don't go through the whole legislative process that it is the identified spokesperson for your community, you know, that they understand. I speak for the entire council when I say this. That's probably the only thing. I mean, stuff moves so fast. Most people just send it into email. One of the things they do is they get, you know, their staff goes through those emails and they pile them up and they go, you know, 54 against, 32 in favor. They don't even care where it comes from. It's just from their district and this is where our tally is.
We really haven't differentiated on how we've done it. We just made sure we communicated it. And we're very fortunate. All of our local legislators have given me their cell phone number. So I call them. And these things don't wait for us to have a city commission meeting so we can pass a formal motion or something like that. Because it just comes up when it comes up and you have to respond quickly. So that's why I'm kind of the designee so I can respond quickly and I'll touch bases when needed. A lot of times I'll just call them. I'll call directly to Wayne or to Tristan or whoever and say, here's what we're going to, city thinks about this, and not even go through the staff to make sure they know exactly where we're at. And then they'll say, like Wayne did this most recent time, hey, can you make sure that somebody does this or that or get me this piece of information so I can make my case effectively. Excellent. We let them take the lead.
Yeah,
and I'm very well read on the issues, but I have not been in practice of responding. I let Mike respond for us, basically. Yeah.
But there are times, and Caroline's exactly right, you know, they know I'm an appointed official. They like to hear from the elected body. And that carries even a little bit more.
Especially if they're in disagreement with your position.
Mm-hmm.
You know. That's one of the most effective coming from an elected official.
An elected official or a certain, depending on what the issue is, like I'll go back to this historic tax credit, you know, I'll contact Glenn Catt or Rich Bergman or some of our local business people, so they're giving that perspective as well, too. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, okay, they can be carrying the same message that we are. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's situations where we might, as elected officials, voice an opinion to our state reps individually as opposed to collectively?
We'll be getting into that.
You know, you will get into that. I mean, you have, we'll talk about it, but you don't really have any individual authority as a council member. Uh-huh. The only thing that counts is what you do together, collective, as a body, that's an action that's reflected in your minutes. So certainly no one can take away your rights as a resident or a citizen, you know, to say, boy, I really feel strongly about this or that. But you're really just speaking for yourself, unless the commission has agreed or the council has agreed that, you know, this is the way we go. Yes, go ahead, reach out and say it's from us. Mm-hmm. You know, but there's a level of trust there.
Yeah.
Depending on your,
so unless you're supporting, unless it's a city position, you should be saying, I'm Dean Solomon, here's what I think about this.
Right.
So if it's a city position and we've all agreed on it, then I'm Dean Solomon, I'm a city commissioner, and I'm speaking for myself, or here's what our group has elected or voted to do.
Yeah. Right. That just keeps you out of trouble.
Now, I can think of that, you know, on that resolution idea when, a year or so, a couple years ago, there was that Line 5 group
yes.
came and talked to you, and then the commission did something, I can't remember what it was, but
we voted as a body.
Voted as
yes.
a body to do something.
Yep.
I'm wondering if that's an appropriate action, especially when our residents come to us with an issue that's bothering them that they'd like us to have.
Yeah, no, that's
there. You've got time.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of times we won't have that.
Yeah,
luxury.
So doing something directly with the legislature, yeah, then we could do that quickly.
You know, kind of a tax on home rule in Elk Rapids. That's just where our council is. If it affects home rule, we hate it. So we know that. The manager and I know that. We have free reign to speak to the council on those kinds of issues. You know, like a Pipeline 5 thing we would discuss. And
exactly.
In fact, I think we passed something. I think a group asked.
It was kind of going around northern Michigan,
yeah.
What, about 2 years ago now?
And we did take that to council because that wasn't, you know, a tomorrow thing.
Yeah, they're still debating
on
that.
In the legislature
yeah.
or
yeah.
anything. So we had that luxury to be able to say, sure. So let me hand this out. One of the fabulous things that the Michigan Municipal League does, they used to call, they do little white papers, but and they used to call them one pagers plus, but no one could ever find them because who remembers that name, right? But it was supposed to be one page plus attached documentation if you needed it. About all kinds of municipal issues in layman's terms. And so I printed just the fact, or just the index for those. You can pass them around to you. You hang on to it, you know, maybe if you three-hole punch this stuff and put it in a binder or put it in a folder. I'm giving you a lot of paper today. Most of you have probably put it in the trash, but if you want to reference it, you can put it in a folder or binder. But these fact sheets are wonderful. So if you want to learn about economic development, if you want to review anything we talked about today about Open Meetings Act and, you know, what were the most recent changes and Freedom of Information Act, and I mean, from A to Z is how they're organized out on their website. I put the link at the bottom. But just a whole host of things. So the next time you're wondering about something or wish you knew a little bit more, maybe start there. I think it's one of the best resources they've ever developed.
You want a copy? If there's an extra one, sure.
I have lots. Do you have one?
Yep.
So, so I just want you to have that as a good resource. They have all kinds of resources, but that's my favorite. I reference those all the time.
Wow.
You know, so. Okay, so we'll talk about local government basics and council manager form of government. So, yeah, this will be a little bit of a test on what you remember from high school. Or maybe never even got in high school. So, the evolution of local government in Michigan. I may sit or stand periodically. There were two ordinances that provided the basic framework for the structure of local government in our state. It's the Land Ordinance of 1785. Which addressed the disposal and settlement of lands, and then Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which addresses governance. These are important because they still affect how we function today. So the Land Ordinance of 1785 established a rectangular grid survey for the establishment of township government, 6 by 6 miles. So that's why we have township government like we do here. Other states don't. Sold sections at public auction for $1 an acre, a little trivia in here. Section 16 lands reserved by the federal government for public education. So who's a Spartan fan?
Yeah, everybody.
No?
Yeah. Reluctantly?
So,
No?
No.
Uh-huh. Well, I used to, yeah. I'm bold.
Michigan was the first state to put sale proceeds into a state endowment for education, so that's the MSU Land Grant College. There we go. The Northwest Ordinance of 1787, territory was intended to be divided into 3 to 5 states. We eventually ended up with 5. It created the right to partial self-governance, you'll love this, upon proof of 5,000 free male inhabitants. I'm pretty sure they all had to be white too, but and then they were guaranteed statehood and equal footing upon reaching 60,000 inhabitants. Okay. So rights that were guaranteed to the people who settled in that region were these: habeas corpus, due process, religious freedom. And slavery was prohibited. Nice to know, right? And then in 1837, we were granted statehood. Just tells you kind of how many people were in the Lower Peninsula alone, so they far exceeded that 60,000 minimum threshold across the state. The election was ratified in a constitution in 1835, but it was all delayed because of the Toledo War. So, you know, sometimes I'm not doing this and I get to quiz people what happened in the Toledo War. Ohio got Toledo, and we got the UP. So, was one of the last acts of President Andrew Jackson, was ratifying our statehood.
Did we learn that in school? About the Toledo War?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Versions of it.
Yeah.
Always hear about the cow or something like that, that cow or pig that got shot.
Did people, a lot of people die?
No. There wasn't any real war.
No, it wasn't.
It was a deal.
It wasn't, right. Yeah.
We made a deal.
I think some people actually stormed someplace, but it was more taunting than probably drinking a beer.
Well, the original boundaries permission was in a little bit part of the south. They called it the Toledo Strip, which was that whole lower, just below the lower tier of counties that was ceded to Ohio.
So in 1837, actually, if you call the state operator, which used to be located actually in the Capitol building, I don't know if they are anymore. It's 517-373-1837.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's the phone number there.
Think about that.
Yeah.
So if you ever have trouble finding it, I suppose you can Google our statehood. So local governments are granted their existence by their state constitutions, and so they are different from state to state. All local governments are political subdivisions of the states and have no inherent right to existence if not for their state constitutions. So what is local control? There's two views on local control. One is called Dillon's Rule. Any doubts concerning power are resolved against the government. So basically, the way their constitutions are written is that Unless kind of specific authorities are granted in their constitution, they don't have that authority. So unless their authority is spelled out as you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, it's assumed you can't, you know, unless they say you can't. And then the flip view of that is home rule, which is what we have here in Michigan. Which is basically you have authority to do what you need to do unless the state says you can't do it. So
I'd always heard that Michigan is really a Dillon state,
Well, it certainly seems a lot more that way.
Yeah. We have home rule cities, but you know, if you're in a township or a county, you really don't have much
authority
unless the state says you do.
We are a home rule state, especially as a city. You have a lot more authority to do the things that you want or need to do. However, you know, that's bounced around quite a bit in the last few years. For a while, we had a whole bunch of legislation that passed that kind of violated home rule principles. Whether you liked or didn't like the Residency Act, you know, that where you could say people have to live here in town.
If they're going to work for us.
Yeah. You know, the legislature eliminated that. There's actually a caveat to it. You can require people to live within 20 miles or more. You can set it farther than that. But those types of things. So right now, who knows what's going on? The legislature is trying to usurp local control.
Or whatever it is.
Yep. Short-term rentals. Right now, that's up to you about how that affects your community. And, you know, kind of have a housing crisis currently. I don't know how you feel about your short-term rentals. It can exacerbate that problem by houses not turning over to families. Right? They're just used is ongoing rentals, and then there's issues in certain communities where, you know, they have what they call dark neighborhoods. People are gone, there's no one living in them because they just get leased out in the summer, and then 9 months of the year they're empty. So there's all kinds of factors. I called Harbor Springs. I said, this is how this affects us. How does this affect you? Well, it affects them completely differently than it affects Elk Rapids. So why would the state tell us how to do this?
You know, one size fits all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's one of those things.
Well, they're doing it because real estate people are telling them.
Oh, right.
Because they feel like there's a, isn't that the argument on the other side?
There is, and there's an argument from you know, private property owner's perspective of I should be able to do what I want with my house. On the other hand, it's zoned residential. Are you using it for a commercial enterprise? Or are you using it for a home? So there's, you know, there's all kinds of arguments.
Do you track that in Elk Rapids? I mean, do you know which homes are being used as rentals and as vacation rentals?
We don't, simply because we don't have the staff for that, but I think we're going to figure out a way. Yeah, because we are greatly affected.
Well, it was interesting. That came up at the Team Boyne meeting today in a couple different ways. One, in relation to last night, the chamber had their business after hours at one of these facilities.
Yeah, right.
One of the things that Team Boyne is looking into is the community's discussion about, hey, we'd really like to have a chain motel or hotel here in the community. And we reached out to the Visitor and Convention Bureau, and one of their arguments back is, well, you might not be able to support a chain hotel in town because you have all mm-hmm. these effective little hotels around that are operating as Airbnbs or whatever, you know, vacation rental by owner type of properties, which is supporting the business that we just went and visited yesterday at the chamber. On the other side, it gets back to the issue potentially with regards to this whole housing. Mm-hmm. If those houses are basically off the market for a family to live in because they're being used for a rental, it just makes our addressing that issue that much tougher. But well, then you have the property rights. So you got all these things that are kind of interrelated together. And, you know,
plus you know, the market demand. You
know. And at one point, we may have, as a commission, you know, we may have to decide, do we want to regulate that area to address some of these issues? And the question we're going to have is, are we even going to be able to, depending on what the state says?
Mm-hmm. And they said, on the internet right now, there's over 200 units in Boyne City that are registered as...
In the city limits?
Not city limits, the community.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
The rental properties north that we went to last night, I asked them, and they said they had like 70 listed, and I'm sure that's in the area around us. So,
well,
and that's just
only,
one business.
Not only do those homes not open up, you know, for families, but they're not available for year-round rental either. Like in Elk Rapids, we have a lot of people who work at Shorts. We have a lot of people who work at Burnett's, and none of them live in town. There's
exactly.
nowhere. There's nowhere for them to live. So, it's a problem. Anyway. Getting back to the point, local control. So, yeah, we do have to speak up.
Well, the league's been good at providing information, and they help workshops.
Yeah, if you get on their list for what do they call it? 208. Their newsletter,
the blog or
Capital newsletter blog that comes out. You'll stay pretty up to date with what's actually moving. You know, if you try to do it on your own, here's the downside. I know this from working in the Senate for 10 years. You have to be pretty astute to, when something's introduced, will it actually go anywhere? So you need to know, like, well, what party introduced it, and what committee did it get sent to, and why did it get sent there, and who's in charge of that committee? And you can figure out, if you work in that environment every day, if something's got legs or not. You know,
so you know when to pick your battles or where you should spend
right.
energy.
Plus,
get mad at or not.
Yeah, plus all that other legislation that you have to sift through that has to do with insurance that maybe doesn't affect the community or health care that maybe does or doesn't affect the community directly. You know, so the league's pretty good at just picking out what it is we need to worry about. So general purpose units, there's a couple different kinds of units of local government that we'll talk about, but general purpose units provide a broad range of services to residents in a number of functional areas. We have a phenomenal number of local governments in the state. That is not the case in other states. Telecommunications industry complains about this all the time because they have to get permission from each local unit of government to do what they want to do, and they're passing services through the community, but it's a good thing. That's another one of those rights that we fight to protect all the time. But you can see where it might be frustrating from an industry viewpoint, because if you add that all up, that's an awful lot of permission to get if you're trying to do something across the state or even regionally.
Yeah.
So then there are special purpose units, which are basically like our school districts or different kinds of authorities. You might have an ambulance authority. You might have a...
Like a library board?
Or recreation authority. Yeah.
The district probably. Library?
Yeah.
Even the conservation district, that's a special unit.
Right, you know.
ISD.
ISDs, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are single-purpose mandated, and then they overlap, you know, other governmental unit boundaries often.
So what's a recreation authority?
It would be a special purpose unit.
Like, what's an example?
Traverse City and Garfield Township.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
We're... Multiple jurisdictions join together to provide recreation in their area.
Mm-hmm.
So,
maybe not an authority, that's a separate authority, right?
I'm not sure if I'm familiar with that one.
Okay.
The biggest one that I'm aware of is in the UP. It is a recreation authority. It's the Iron Ore Heritage Trail, and it's 51 miles.
Right.
And every single unit that it passes through is part of that authority.
Hmm.
Yep. That last I knew, that was the biggest one in the history of our state.
And there's a sunset provision on that, right? It's going to end at some point in time?
I don't really know.
Okay.
I don't really know the answer.
On that one in particular or special units?
Yeah. Well, either or.
I'm not familiar that they have to expire after a certain time.
You don't have a vote every 5 or 10 years or something like that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Might be on their millages, you might have to, but not the organization itself, I wouldn't think.
Right,
for collecting resources, okay.
I know the library millage comes up every so often.
Not anymore, no.
But didn't they change something?
Yeah, it's set, so it stays the same. So it doesn't come up for a vote.
So, of the kinds of cities we have in Michigan, just in case you ever know, or you need to know, there's home rule and fourth class cities. Fourth class cities were established, you know, a long time ago. Everybody was kind of supposed to update in 1980. It was like, yeah, we empty out all these fourth class cities, change them over to home rule cities, and we'll be good to go. But some communities still haven't done that. So we still have some fourth class cities.
We are a home rule city. So.
Yeah. There's two types of townships. There's general law townships and charter townships. They are administrative subdivisions of the county. Some functions that these townships and cities provide are assessing property, collecting taxes for counties and schools, and conducting county, state, and national elections. Villages. There are two types of villages. They're general law villages. That's what the Village of Elk Rapids is. They have to have a population of over 750 to be a general law village. And then there are home rule villages as well, and they don't have that population number constraint. They function like cities, but they're not administratively autonomous from townships. Like, we've given our elections to our township. When that was an option for cities and villages to consider, or for villages to consider, we did that. So important for you to know about your charter, and maybe this goes a little out of order from some of the rest of my presentation, but your charter is basically your city constitution. So, you know, it's the governing document of your local unit of government, whereas we have state and federal constitutions. So this is your charter is your constitution.
Basically. Does everybody know where their charter is? It's in that black notebook right in the front of the book. So it's really not that long a read if you want to work your way through it too, but it's kind of the general framework for everything else.
It is. And then ordinance is, just so you understand, same as on the local level, same as a state or federal law.
One thing that's interesting about reading the charter is the number of times that there's a sentence in there, preempted by this, that, or that section of the state law. So it kind of emphasizes your point where, you know, the state does have, they created us, right?
Right.
So they have considerable authority to be able to preempt us as well.
Mm-hmm. So city government, that's you guys, conducts state-imposed duties that are conducted. We kind of covered this before, but, you know, sometimes I don't give this presentation to cities, so it varies. Assessing property, collecting taxes, registering voters, and conducting the elections. Cities are authorized to levy a city income tax. I don't know if you've ever looked at that. It's really hard to do unless you happen to be a community where you get an enormous influx of workers from other places during the day and they leave. Because if you institute a city income tax, it's usually at a higher rate for non-residents who work in the city, and that's where the city garners its profit from, which makes sense because they're using all of your infrastructure, right? So then they're not paying for any of it because they don't live there. So it's worth it sometimes, like if your city, I don't know why I'm expounding on this because it's probably not worth it for you, but if you know, I worked in the city of Lansing. I lived like east of East Lansing. I had to pay their income tax. But I paid like 1.5% and their residents pay like 0.5%. The residents have to pay it, a portion of it or part of it.
Because they're getting paid both the income tax and probably property tax as well, mm-hmm. too.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
We don't do that, do we?
So it works really well if you've got a large influx from the surrounding area that work here every day, but if you don't, it's not usually your residents will usually go for it.
Yeah, we haven't looked at it since I've been here.
Fourth Class City Act, we covered that. Governing structure. So there are three governing structures for cities. There's the weak mayor council form of government, which I know very little about because it's not very common or popular. There's a strong mayor council form of government, which are larger cities. You know, you've seen the Chicago, New York, Detroit, sorry, yeah. And then council manager form of government, which is what we have here, and then we'll learn a little bit more about that as we go. And it is by far the most common. So we launch right into it. Understanding the council manager form of government. So this goes back to the historical background in the 1900s industrial revolution, where we had extremely fast growth. We had a lot of immigrants that moved into the country to do factory type work, got all kinds of jobs. But then we had a lot of political corruption at that time. The political leaders would exchange favors for immigrant voting blocks. So, you know, if you want to have this bridge project over here so that you're able to get from point A to point B, you'll vote this way. You know, and they controlled a lot of things that way. So some of those, you know, names that you would hear is like Boss Tweed. He's one of the most fascinating. Third largest owner had in the city, or of the city, had a railway, a bank, and a printing company. So pretty much controlled everything. He was convicted of stealing $25 to $45 million in taxes, but that's just what he was convicted of. The corruption was incredibly deep and rampant.
And that's when a million used to mean something.
It is. Yeah. You know, again, the Chicago stockyards, you know, that was another big area of corruption. You get blacklisted if you didn't pay. You know, the police would come around and extort money from you and... So, vote early and vote often, that's a phrase you've heard, right? That's been attributed, that goes back as far as William Hale Thompson, who I know nothing about.
And how often do you hear that on election day?
But you
people
do.
Say joking.
And jokingly. It's also, jokingly. Also been attributed, you know, more more recently to Al Capone and Mayor Daley. So, you know, and remember, Chicago's still got a strong mayor form of government. We don't have a council manager form of government. Same with Detroit. So this was known as the patronage system, and it is the progressive era in our history that addressed this and made the changes that we are living with today. It's just an interesting little political cartoon. The longer you look at it, the more you'll see. I'm not even really sure what year it refers to, but you've got the den of corruption and fraud is what it says in the background. I don't know if you can read that. He's got a little prison uniform sticking out at the bottom. I think it's supposed to be a fat cat. It says the curious effect of clean linen upon the Democratic Party. So it was a pretty seriously corrupt time. I love this cartoon though, because the longer you look, the more you find. So the progressive movement took place from 1890 to 1920. Theodore Roosevelt was involved, Woodrow Wilson. I know absolutely nothing about Louis Brandeis, but he's always mentioned if you look at the history of this. And they ended the patronage system that we just talked about, which was basically exchanging favors for votes. And they created the civil service system, which at this point, you know, we're all a little bit jaded about bureaucracy and the civil service system. But at the time, it was a really good thing, you know, and structurally probably still works pretty well for the most part. So part of the civil service system, what they created were the written exams and pay scales, and basically kept people from being hired or fired because they were related to somebody or dismissed because they weren't related to somebody. And he really tried to get professionals into the position instead of just being appointed as a favor to whoever you knew in the political system. It did limit the power of the political bosses. This is interesting. So it takes key appointments away from mayors and governors by creating separately elected clerks, judges, and sheriffs. Can you imagine before judges and sheriffs were separately elected? When they were all appointed by whoever was in charge? You know, so that's the beginnings of the council manager form of government. They created this profession of public managers modeled after the business model of chief executive officers. Your manager is supposed to be insulated from politics and would run, you know, the bureaucracy in an efficient manner. And so this is the chain of command in the council manager form of government. You probably understand this well here, but other places struggle. Voters, you know, the council is responsible to the voters, the residents. The manager is hired by the council and is responsible to the council, accountable to the council for all things that are listed as such in your charter, which we'll get to in a little bit. And then the manager has all authority and purview for the department heads. And this is where we often find some points of difficulty on the local government level is council members sometimes find themselves getting involved with daily operations. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but that's not really the role of the elected official in a council manager form of government. Sometimes I think when people run for office, they don't realize what form of government that their particular community actually has, and then they get in office and they become a little bit disillusioned or disappointed that they can't do what they thought they were going to be able to do when they got there. You know, so there's always, I shouldn't say always, but there's often tension, a little bit of tension there from people who kind of didn't realize that. I mean, when I lived in the city of Gladstone, we had a commission member that just came right out and told the paper, I was told if I ran for, you know, city commission, I would be able to do this and this and this and this, and now I get here and I find out I can't do any of that. I should have probably kept that little quote. But it happens more often than we think, so it's worth going over. And I think it is important as elected officials that if you have city staff members or department heads that are coming to you and kind of whispering in your ear about things, that you direct them in the appropriate direction, and that you let the manager know as well, so that can be cleared up, because sometimes that causes problems.
So last night at the event that several of us were at, it's a business after hours kind of thing, a constituent came up, a citizen, and had some thing to say. Says, "I've made your ear for a minute," and had something to say about sidewalks.
Oh.
And I said, "You know, this is with the city manager about that." He says, "Yes, I don't get anywhere." So what does an elected official do with that? I know we do not want to be involved.
You talk to Mike and you say,
relay to the city, the manager,
and then you ask him to be accountable to letting you know what happens. Okay. You know, sometimes action is warranted. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes people don't really understand how it functions. One of the problems that arises pretty frequently will be with DPW services. You know, you might be out and see a need for something, or somebody from your DDA might be out and see a need for something and say, "Hey, you know, I thought this should have been cleaned up by Sunday and it's now Wednesday. Why is this still here?" Well, the DPW director, as well as the rest of the department heads, have a schedule that they go through, you know, with the manager, who understands what the priorities are on any given day. You know, we had somebody who wanted something taken care of, and it's like, well, I understand, other than, you know, our DPW doesn't work on Saturday and they don't work on Sunday. We don't have overtime authorized in the budget, so we can't change that. And then we had a snowstorm for 2 days. So while it would have been taken care of probably on Monday, it's not going to be taken care of until probably Thursday. You know, so it's just that kind of thing. And if elected officials get sucked in too far, then department, we'll talk about it later, but the employees don't know who they're accountable to, and they get pulled in a couple different directions, and it causes problems. So, but those are probably the most frequent problems with council manager, form of government. Would you agree? Yeah? No?
Yeah. It's never been too much of a problem here.
That's good.
I've always had pretty good luck with the commissioners kind of feeding me information and then trying to report back and say, okay, here's what we can do or can't do, or if we want to do something different, maybe we need to talk about in the budget process or set a new policy or something of that nature. But we've never had too much of a problem with that.
Yeah. And we go through a couple different questions, and yeah, again, you know, bear with me if it's, you know, not at your level, because we do these trainings for all kinds of different communities. And
so people should ask questions as we're going along or something like that.
Yep. Well, as long as they're going fast enough, because
if you're going to revisit that's fine, because that you're 100% right. That's small town USA. Mm-hmm. You know, they
we will
bend our ear. Okay, if you're going to revisit that, I'll hold off. Okay.
Yep. Okay. So, any questions about that before we go on to roles and responsibilities, in which we'll cover that? No. Yes. Good. All right. Okay. bear with me here. Ooh, look at me go. Okay. Roles and responsibilities. Now remember, I have taken this from 3 hours down to, less than an hour. 30.
And you, are these the pretty much the same ones that you sent me in advance or something like that? And is there any problem with me sharing these PowerPoints to any commissioners that want them or something like that?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
You got paper copies for us to follow along with?
Knock, knock.
Yeah, here we go. There's the one we just went through, in case you wanted to take notes on that. I'm sorry. I wasn't organized last night and earlier today.
That agenda thing threw you off, I think.
It might have. Here's roles and responsibilities, which we're covering now. I even have nice, good handouts that you can actually are big enough to read.
I was wondering if they mailed it to you.
You said they would.
Well, yeah, usually aren't the quickest.
I'm just going to put everything in the refrigerator. Okay.
So I don't know how much you got out of that local government structure stuff or, the history of council manager stuff, but sometimes it's good to have a little perspective on where it originated.
It's too bad.
Otherwise, people who get involved go, why in the world do they do it that way?
Say it a little
too
louder.
Too bad we can't get rid of townships. Does Ohio have townships? Mm-hmm. Does Wisconsin have townships?
I don't know if he does or he doesn't. I know that managers who work in Illinois really love it there.
They do have townships there? Or?
I don't think they have to deal with. They have all kinds of things they don't have to deal with.
Interesting you say that, Hugh. I worked a lot with townships, and Michigan Townships Association. Their line is, everything would be great if it weren't for these darn cities. Yeah. That they are always trying to usurp our power. They're trying to suck in our resources. They want to, to annex it. They have more power than we do, and so it really is oftentimes a conflict.
It does seem 2,500 units is overkill.
More than most of it.
Especially if
Engler had a dream of eliminating township government.
I heard that townships got started because it was the length of it was the distance you could travel on a horse
in a day
to vote.
I know. I've heard that too, and we used to teach that, but then I kind of took it out of my presentation because I was probably like, can't you get farther than 6 miles on a
horse? Well, the point was that back when it made
before they had trails,
because you only had a certain communication distance.
Well, that's it. Yeah, maybe it's the whole 36 or 24. 24. Maybe it took 24. Maybe that's how many miles you got in a day 24. If you went the whole perimeter.
I never
really heard how that worked in that 6x6 square mile. But anyway, so roles and responsibilities.
Okay, then I'll stop.
Do you have something?
Well, I was just going to say, we can talk about the elimination of townships. I don't think it's ever going to happen. Yeah. There's more population in townships.
You do broadcast this, right? You don't offend any of your neighbors.
Once you get some,
it's never going
to
happen.
Probably not in our lifetime, anyway.
No.
But there's no law that says you can't work effectively with the townships.
That's the thing. Yeah. Exactly.
It's all personality. Yeah.
Right. And 425s.
Yeah.
Or not.
Or not. That causes tension.
Yep, and it does. And it gets right back to the issue that we're talking about here, exactly. Where they feel that they're being usurped or something like that. Mm-hmm. And we feel that there's times that they're free rides. I mean, those are the arguments that are out there.
So, roles and responsibilities for the council. And again, this is what I started to say. Remember, I crunched all this down. So every once in a while, there's kind of an awkward transition from slide to slide because I had to remove some things, but so policy making in the legislative body for the local unit of government, that's you guys, that's what you do, that's your role, the kind of higher level bird's eye view perspective. Where are we, where do we want to go, how do we see ourselves 10 years from now, what goals do we need to set to get there? So that's the role of the elected official. Right? So, like I just said, responsible for long and short-term goal setting, passing the budget, and any capital improvement plans. You have authority to act only as a body. This is so hard for people to grasp sometimes, through resolutions and ordinances. And any actions that are reflected in your minutes, truly, is your authority as a body. Is what.
And we do ours mainly through motions. A lot of communities use really formal resolutions and things of that nature.
Oh, yeah.
We've always kind of been... Yeah.
Yeah, we changed that in Elk Rapids. We had, I think the first year I was there, we had in excess of 150 resolutions.
What's the difference between a motion and a resolution?
So far, we're on 36 this year, 37. Which is even a lot more than other places. I called around and said, how many resolutions do you pass in a year? And it's like, this, anywhere from 15 to 20. I'm at 36, but that's a far cry from 150 where we were.
Is there any functional difference between a motion and a resolution?
Well, you know, we use resolutions for, you know, things that are going to go to the state level. You know, like we'll pass our 5-year community recreation plan. We'll do that by resolution.
I see.
We just contracted with an audit firm for 5 years. We did that by motion. You know.
Like when we adopt our budget, we have budget resolutions and things
resolutions
of that nature.
Yes.
It's a little more formal, but functionally, I've never really noticed a difference between them. I mean, that's the will and that's the expressed desire of the city commission. That's our authority to do what needs, whatever it's said to be, do or not do.
Yeah, we just kind of do a judgment call on whenever we're putting the agenda together. Like, what's the level of importance here? Right, with budget resolutions always, yeah.
Carolyn, are we going to dig down at any of these items later? Or,
these things right here?
Well, I was wondering about the policy making part of it and setting goals and, you know, how we do that and how a committee should function doing that sort of thing, because it seems like a lot of what we do is say yes or no to something, you know, something that comes prepared to the commission and we vote on it. And we don't spend a lot of time. We do a community-wide goal-setting session, which I don't
think... Well, that's huge.
Well, I don't find that very helpful to the commission, though, as far as how we do certain things. But is there, I mean, is there something that... Like, how do you do it in Elk Rapids?
They have not done any kind of goal setting in Elk Rapids for a long time, at least as far as I'm aware. And I've talked about that a little bit, and so I'd really like to see us get, you know, some community-wide goals set down and then, or priorities set down and then try and set our goals on a path to get there. Those goals have to be flexible, because sometimes what would be maybe the fifth priority on the list, you have an opportunity to submit grant, you know, grant funding for or obtain grant funding for, and so that might move up from number 5 to number 2.
Mm-hmm.
And you do rely in large part, I think, on your staff to let you know about those opportunities. And, you know, you might have a priority 1 where local politics, you know, in the region are such that it's like, boy, that is just not going to move. It is our top priority, but 1, we don't have the money, or 2, we've got too much opposition right now. You know, and it can stay at number 1, but you gotta start working on the other things as well. So I don't know what you've done with your community input, if that was broken down by categories. And then those categories looked at by the council to say, you know, what do we think should be the priority based on the amount of input that we got and based on reality? You know, what can we really do or not do? So I don't know, Mike, do you have something to offer? If you have community input, you've come a long way from a lot of places.
See, I've always thought... I mean, I think you just heard it from Caroline. That's one of the things that sets us apart from a lot of communities. We go through the process on a regular basis and structured. And there may be ways to improve, but just by what we're doing already, we're so far ahead of where a lot of other communities are that don't even go through the process.
Never ask the question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we should always should be looking for ways to do it better and to get more community input, and that's kind of the things, you know, we're working on right now to before we go through our process again. But just that we're doing it.
Yeah.
But then the commission has to figure out, once we get that input, because I've always seen, like, the community process as a start of a discussion for the city commission is, here's what the community is saying, but then we still have to figure out what are the priorities, because we can come up with a laundry list of 10 great things or 20 great things to do, but unless you say, well, here are the three or four that we're going to focus on, it doesn't give any direction to staff. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's how we got, that's what I look for the goal setting process, the commission to say, here's what we really want to focus, here's the top things that we're going to do. And that's why we tried to break it down differently than this last time. So.
Well, I think too, you know, with we started this process about 20 years ago, you know, citywide planning sessions. And I think the very first, you know, citywide sessions was, you know, to get the waste treatment off the waterfront, the waste treatment plant. And even like the city hall, it was probably 12 or 13 years on the citywide planning session, one of the top 10 goals.
Right, it takes a long time.
So it really gives the council leverage to, you know, make decisions, you know, to do these things, big ticket ones, like $7.5 million for this building here and $8.5 million for the waste treatment plant. And we have the naysayers say we don't need this, but thing is, it isn't, you know, five people deciding what the city needs, it's what the city asked us to do. So you do have that leverage. So I think it's really important to carry on the tradition of doing it. I mean, it's...
Right. People can't come back and say, well, that's your personal pet project that you got elected to, you know, usher in. It's like, well, no, actually we have all these community surveys that indicate this is important to our residents. And so it's on our list for when we're able to pull the funding together or, you know, whatever other things. Broadband was on our list for a long time, and then we were kind of defeated in that process before my time, like 2012, I think, or 13. And so now it's kind of resurfaced back up again. But it would be really nice to have all that, you know, intuitively you understand where it's coming from and the importance of it, but it'd be really nice to have the community input to be able to say, here's where, you know, people recognize this as a priority. It's not just coming from the Chamber of Commerce, or it's not just coming from, you know, one or two businesses. Anyway.
Well, I guess to build on that, so I think sometimes our frustration is, okay, we have Parks and Rec is one of our main goals. Improve our recreation is one of our citywide goals. So under that, we say, okay, we have 10 things that we could do. Create better walking trails, create better ice skating rink, create better pathways into town. And you know, I can keep going. And then if those don't get through the process of budget, mm-hmm. and they don't get passed on down through department heads, and they don't get, for those reasons, don't get to create a high priority, then us commissioners get frustrated for another year because things didn't happen.
Approved the budget.
Analysis?
So.
Well, we do the budget, but it's so far from doing budget in March compared to creating that walkway along the riverbank in June, there seems to be a disconnection sometimes.
Well, I mean, you need to know what's it going to cost, and you know, have you put aside money so that you can match grant money with it, you know, and sometimes you have to build the pot from year to year, but none of it's fast, especially like I just got a DNR grant, you know, and that application process. One, it's grueling. Two, it's really lengthy, you know. So from the time, and we've been notified that we were awarded the grant, but by the time the state releases the funds is another, you know, you may have gone through two or three budget cycles
you know, and then you have to fight to keep that money in there as your priority, you know.
Yeah, we're in the process of one of those grant cycles right now with the open space project that we're looking to
purchase. If we didn't have $100,000 sitting in the pot to match the DNR grant, we wouldn't be able to do it. Well, the first year they think they put in $50,000, which is huge for Elk Rapids. And then the second year they put in another $50,000. But if I'd have tried to go out for a grant, well, I wasn't there, but if I'd tried to go out for a grant 2 years ago, we wouldn't have had enough to make it. You know, so all of that, all of those things take time. And then of your list of priorities, you might have an opportunity to get one or two done that were two or three on the list because you don't have enough for number one, or all your ducks just aren't, the stars don't always align.
I could take a perfect example that I've heard coming up a lot during the last year. Let's do the bathrooms. We want to do bathrooms. Yeah. But then we don't put the money in the budget. That pretty much ends the discussion on bathrooms for that year. Because you can tell me all we want that we want to do bathrooms, but unless we put that money in the budget.
Mm-hmm. But would we know what money to put in the budget? I don't, like, it's in the capital improvement plan at $50,000, and there's no way that that's going to cover it. I mean, we're not like dealing with real numbers.
Yeah,
I
but mean, when we go to the budget, we should have that discussion and say, okay, well, this is a really important item for the commission. We might not know exactly what it is. Put $100,000 there. That'll more than cover the bathrooms, and then you go forward. That's when you have that discussion for the things you want to get done in that next year.
I think one of the other challenges is the tendency to have too many goals and too many things that are high priority. At some levels, everything's a high priority because people said it was a high priority in our meetings and our surveys. But I think when you have too many things on the list, nothing gets done. Everybody's frustrated because you don't know where you are, you know, on the list. So by really being very clear as a commission, there are three things we want to happen this year. One is bathrooms. And the second is whatever second is, and third is whatever third. And here's the corresponding either grant dollars we're looking for or money that we're allocating in the budget to do those highest of the high priority things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think you get trapped, you know, into it. Doesn't mean the other things are unimportant. You wouldn't do that if you had the opportunity. But by golly, if we want bathrooms done, we have to say that is priority number one, and here's the money.
Okay, my question is, when do we say that?
At the budget time.
Well,
the budget is complete, and we've got 12 hours that we're trying to digest in 12 hours.
Yeah.
And the numbers are already there.
Yeah.
So
The budget that the staff presents you is a starting point, and if there's something that you don't see in that budget, and let's just use bathrooms as an example. Mike, where's the money for bathrooms? Well, we didn't put it in there. Well, we really think, you know, then you say, and then the rest of the commission says, well, yeah, that's really important. Okay, we come back with an amendment that says we put in 100 or 150,000, whatever our best guess is. We don't have to have a complete budgeted number.
In what fund?
Well, right, but that's the trick that you're going to have is, okay, we want to spend 150,000 on bathrooms because that's going to do what we think we want to have done. Where's that 150,000 come from? Because something's going to have to fall off the pot. We're going to have to take money out of the fund balance, or we're going to have to come up with new money someplace else.
And if you put that money designated for that purpose, how untouchable is it?
It's untouchable until
something else and it goes somewhere else.
No, staff can't. It's untouchable until the commission says there's something else you want to do with that money and they move it.
Okay.
So I guess my to me it seems real simple because we present a budget that's going to pay for these things and we tell you what it's going to pay for. And if there's something on there that really is important to the commission that's not in there, you say, go back and put bathrooms in. And we'll put bathrooms in and we'll make a couple other changes somewhere to pay for those bathrooms or tell you why we can't.
Is there a step?
Or tell you, you know, well, this year we can do 50,000. That's where we found we had room to cut. So we can start, but you're going to need 150,000, so it's going to take more than 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Or come up with a plan,
You know, and if somebody says, boy, it seems like we're never going to get there, maybe we should go to the voters and ask for a millage. Could only be a year, or something, you know, however much you collect, and it could cover the bathroom and maybe something else. I don't know how big you're, I don't have a concept in my head of what you can collect with one mill or a half a mill, or maybe that's important to you. Oh my goodness, we don't want to raise the millage, you know, so you don't. So then you wait. So, I mean, it's all of those pieces that move. You know, and you have to figure out what works.
But once the budget is set, it's set until...
It's set until the commission amends it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the lesson that I'm taking away from this is I have to be more proactive. I have to get down in the weeds more to speak. I have to be more specific when we go through our winter budget setting. And I have to say, I definitely want bathrooms, and I want the bid done so we know how much is going to be done before we approve it on May 1st.
No, you don't want. You don't need the bid done or any of that stuff. No, you just say you want the bathrooms done, put the money in for the bathrooms, and then we take our guess at it.
But we have talked philosophically about those things, but we don't get down to specifics enough is maybe the lesson I'm taking away, or should take away.
Well, my lesson is okay, what's our priority been? Purchase the open space. And bathrooms and other things got pushed off to the side because of that. Those are the types of discussions we should be having as we go through the budget process. Yeah. We come up with our laundry list, and if there's something that is on there that you don't think is important, or there's something that's not on there that you think is important, that's the time we need to have those discussions.
Can we have like a pre-discussion about what we think is important before you go into the preparation of the budget?
Yeah, and I ask those questions all the time.
How long does the budget preparation take? How long are you working on the budget before it?
Oh, months. Months.
Well, I mean, half
it seems
year.
Like there's two parts of
it. No. It's probably about 2 months.
Okay. Well, starting when? Tell Sally when you start.
We'll be really getting into it in January. The department heads get their information to me by February, and then we have to present it to the commission in March, and then we adopt it in April.
Okay.
Seems like there's two parts of that budget process. One is the operational things that you generally deal with, and you know they go up a little bit, they change here and there from year to year, and you those things I don't think there's a lot of debate or discussion about. It's the capital expenditure for priorities that, and I wonder if even in the beginning, early in the year or late in the previous year, there was more discussion about that specific element as a to set the stage for that part of the budget. Maybe that might be things a little less frustrating when you get to March, you're looking at the whole thing put together.
And we've used, again, that's kind of the timeline I was tossing about a couple of commissions a meetings ago, that you know it's helpful to have a goal setting process so we have the general community priorities and that type of stuff as a feeder for you folks to help give direction to me as to what should be in that budget. I come back with regards to that. Before we get off this topic too much, and I don't want to go too far into the weeds, also keep in perspective that the last couple of years, this building,
I agree,
and the open space have been the two highest priorities I've been given by the city commission.
And the DPW building.
Well, that was before that, and we worked our way through that.
Yeah,
but
it was still.
And those have taken time and resources with regards to it. So those are kind of this process you're talking about. Those are two capital projects that have basically dwarfed everything else.
Sucked up all the energy.
It really has. Yeah. It really has. So some of these other things, we didn't have the time or we didn't have the resources to do it.
Right.
So.
But that will change.
Yeah. And, you know, so whether it's bathrooms or trails or whatever it is, we need to make, if it's not there in the budget, you can pretty much forget about it for that next year. Unless the commission says we need to amend the budget and this changes.
But the way I see it, though, you know, for the last couple of years, as far as, you know, approving the budget is that, like you've just stated, you know, we didn't know for a while how much money we were going to have to come up with for the matching grant for the open space. And if you go and allocate that money to the bathrooms now and you say it's got to come out of the general fund because you've got a real tight budget, then that money goes into the restricted column. So you don't have the, you know, usable fund balance, and you want to keep at least 25%, you know, equity as far as a rainy day fund. It's a juggling act.
And
bathrooms is probably going to be a $150,000 deal.
That was the one for the Rivermouth bathroom. We got a price on that. Yeah. We all saw the price because we tried to see if there was a way to fit that in someplace, and it didn't work because we didn't have the money available. We tried.
Yeah.
And part of the budget process is also trying to time that with grant opportunities. I get that too. Yeah. So.
Well, that's where the goals really help out, because if we see what the goals are and have these big pictures, then we can say, okay, kind of like what Caroline was saying, you steer and you say, okay, here's one we can grab because there's a grant opportunity for that or whatever.
And we have,
I'm not too
have,
worried about the timing of it short term.
Your order.
Yeah, it does. You know, but that's always discussed in a council meeting, and he's like, yeah, here's where we're at. You know, do you do a staff report?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah. He said, well, here's where we're at on this. We're not going to be able to make headway on restrooms this year because of XYZ. However, this opportunity arose, so you need to make a decision. Are we keeping all that money in that pot for the restrooms, or are you willing to take out, you know, $15,000 to match something we can do over here?
That goes. I'm glad we're talking about it.
Or you leave it all there. But, yeah, I mean, that's the time, and, you know.
Yeah, it gets...
It's frustrating. It takes time.
And to Mike's credit, you know, we've got $9 million over his tenure here in grant money, which is 50 cents on the dollar or 30 cents on the dollar. I mean, we've done a lot more than $9 million worth of improvements.
You guys are rocking and rolling here.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm disillusioned, because I'm very pleased with the direction we've been. It's just, I have to be more proactive in learning how to get exactly what we want. And it has to happen during the budget process.
All right, so we're going to go back to roles and responsibilities here. So I kind of harp on this, so I apologize about it, but you can act only as a body through ordinance and resolutions, or as indicated in the minutes. Just so you know that. That's one of those things of, you know, you might feel like you're closer to, you know, what's going on at City Hall, so you kind of like, you know, you see somebody who's trimming the hedges at a certain place in the park, you know, and the landscaper's there, and you come up and you're like, why are you doing that? I thought we were doing this. You know, you can do that as a resident. You can't do that as a council member, you know, and as a resident, someone like the city manager could come and say, please don't interrupt the workflow. We're paying these individuals. You know, it's been an improved expenditure and it's taxpayer dollars. So please come and speak to the city council if you're unhappy with the way this went. Or please bring that to my office if you're unhappy with the way it went. But, you know, so you have to keep your role separate. Because, a lot of times I think people get closer to stuff and then they see something and they're like, hey, why is that happening that way? That's not what we talked about. But you can't intervene because you don't have that authority as an individual. You can only, you know.
But it is appropriate to express concern through Mike, right?
Through Mike, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then he dogs it down for you and gets the answers. So,
I kind of reflect back on my days of being on two different bank boards, and every time, maybe two or three years, we'd have board training, just a refresher course, and it seemed like it always started out with, what is your job description? And it comes down to a simple one-liner, and it's create policy and allocate resources,
mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah.
It isn't to micromanage. Yep.
Right. But you will have people who approach you in the grocery store, at the gym, or wherever. And I think this is where the difficulty comes in. You've had lots of practice, right? But where the difficulty comes in is, what hat are you wearing? Because everyone approaches you as though you're wearing your city council hat. And it's like, well, yeah, not really at the moment. But you can listen and let staff know, or let Mike know, well, this is what I heard, and would you be so kind as to get me an answer for that? Or would you be so kind as to let me know when you contact Mrs. Smith and, you know, get her up to speed on that? Just so that you know that, you know, you heard what the constituents had to say and that you were responsive. You know, whether or not they were content with that response, you provided what you needed to do as an elected official, which was, you know, find an answer.
But you don't have to be the ones to follow through on that. Somebody else does, and then that somebody else is accountable to you. Right? So, judge fitness of other members. So on your council, and I'm sure this works well here in Boyne City, but if you occasionally you get somewhere where, you know, you might have some ethics questions with a member of council, which are not here, other communities, or you'll have civility issues, how people are addressing each other, being respectful or not. And so all of you have...
we've been through those.
We've had our moments.
A level of responsibility to help keep that all in check. You know,
just don't get on my case for lack of exercise, if that's what fitness means. I'm...
So and then civility towards others, practice it, enforce it, you know, just be consistent so that it's not part of your culture to be uncivil. I actually had a council meeting where I actually threatened to leave. Like, I'd driven a really long way to be there. Like, wow, I don't think I can stay if you keep this up. Because it just was, people were swearing at each other and calling each other names, and it was just crazy. I'm sure.
I thought that's what the constituents are for.
But right, it was council members against each other, and just very clearly no level of respect, and it just all kind of degraded, and it's like, wow, this is going to be tough.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that civility to ourselves.
So that's
we don't
why
have to agree, in fact, we probably won't agree all the time, but to speak civilly, you know, to one another, especially when we're in an open session, you know, and then to really respect one another, even when we don't agree, is, you know, that really says a lot. And it says, and oh, you know, just when before the election, when I was coming to the meetings and watching how you all work, and people are just nice to one another, even when they don't necessarily agree.
Agree.
And sitting there as an audience member, that really made an impact on me and a big difference in how people perceive your community.
Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah, it does have a ripple effect for sure. So we talked about,
ask Mike a question.
Yeah.
There was a thing with Evangeline Township that the Main Street Board signed. What was that?
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to bring that up. At the Main Street Board meeting, you might have seen it in the minutes, Michelle Courtright came up with a little thing about civility and how to treat each other. And I'll email a copy of that to each of you. The Main Street Board adopted it. It was something that the Evangeline Township Board did. She brought it there and then brought it to the Main Street Board. It may be something you want to look at as a commission and see if that's something you want to adopt, or just keep it on the back of your mind or something like that. I'll get it to you and you guys can ask me if you want it, or tell me if you want it on the agenda or something like that.
Sure. I do have a question about, like, we may only act as a body and not to get involved in daily operations. I know as a body, it's really easy for us to tell Mike to do stuff. You know, we say, Mike, we think you ought to do this. I mean, you know, in our sessions, say we want this and this is a priority. But to what degree should us as individuals become involved? And let me give an example that we've talked about, that in that public input process stuff is kind of important to me. I talked about that when I was running and have a little expertise in that. To what degree would it be appropriate for me as an individual commission member to be working with Mike and the staff to craft a process?
You know, I'll leave that to your manager to answer, because you know, I actually run into a little bit of that same problem myself. It's like, how much should I be facilitating? Because what effect do I have then on the response?
Oh, not facilitating, but helping to design the process with Mike, not in the session with people.
To build
the process. And like another example could be, you know, let's say you get housing issues, you know, and let's say there was a particular passion about one of the members, and that person really wanted to be really involved with staff in helping to craft policies and approaches to present to the commission or to set as priorities.
Yeah,
to,
you know,
to what
that's
degree?
Up to your manager. Yeah.
Well, it's up to the, let's go back to the goal setting one and priority, because Dean's offered that a couple of times to me, and Dean's obviously helped us with our goal setting processes through the years. And I certainly don't have any problems on that issue, using his expertise and things to say, hey, how can we help improve that? as long as the rest of the commission's comfortable with it. So, as far as I'm concerned, Dean's offering, I'm willing, and it's up to the commission to say, you know, are you comfortable with Dean participating in it? I think Dean wants to make sure he's not overstepping his bounds right. with the rest of the commission right. or with me.
Right.
And if I ever feel a commissioner is overstepping their bounds, I'll tell you. I mean, you'll get a phone call from me or something of that nature. I generally don't have any problems with commissioners asking general questions of employees and things of that nature. But if it becomes too interruptive and things like that, I'll basically say, I'll call you up and try and rein it in and say, okay, I think that needs to be more appropriately coming through here. It's becoming disruptive. Mm-hmm. So.
Along the lines, I can think of three citizens on three different issues that contact me quite regularly with their concerns. And I would usually pass, I always just emailed Mike and said, so-and-so talked to me about these issues. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll bring it up right now. Let's just talk about Eleanor Stackus and the cemetery.
Eleanor calls me a lot. She
me
calls
too.
Ron a lot and with cemetery issues, and I pass it on to Mike. And on the other hand, I have ridden with Eleanor many times through the cemetery so she can point them out, and it just gives me an opportunity to point out specifically to Mike as to what needs to be done. Same thing with Bill up on...
Bill Kuhn.
Bill Kuhn.
Oh,
he contacts me regularly, monthly, on progress or lack of progress. And then when Ron
Crozier
visits me, I pass that on to Ron or to Mike. So yeah, I mean, are we talking the same thing? I'm passing constituent concerns on to Mike.
How does it work in the other direction? Eleanor probably has some expectation of something.
Yes.
Do you, as a commissioner, get back to Eleanor and say, I had this conversation with Mike, and that whatever, if there was resolution or not resolution, or something that you could...
I've told her, Eleanor, we've talked about your concerns, and some were being taken care of, and some we're not going to do. And I'm pretty blunt with Eleanor. She's pretty blunt with me, and with all of us.
Sure.
So I do get back to her. I do get back to Bill. I pass your concerns on. I don't know.
And those are calls that you're going to have to make as to, and at some point I may make suggestions to you as to how much do you keep entertaining those questions coming in, or how much time, or at what point do you say, I've done what I can, or you need to go work that out with the manager directly and get yourself out of the middle of it.
Yeah.
Like on Eleanor, there's certain things, I mean, she wants to see a lot of things done at the cemetery. And we budget, and again, this is where the budget becomes a limitation as to what all is going to be done on some of it. Some of it's just time management and things of that nature, what our priorities are, getting, you know, things done by the DPW. But if, you know, all of a sudden she wants all the trees removed or something like that, or a bunch of trees cut, well, if we don't have that money in the budget, you know, she can talk to you every other week about that. It's not going to get done.
All 86 of them.
Yes.
All 86 of them, you know, and you know, we can take 10 down in a month. Yeah. I think we're doing pretty good.
But Eleanor and some of those people, they will target you.
Yes.
And especially if you're commissioners, that will listen to them and give them the ear, because they didn't get the answer that they wanted somewhere else down the road.
Right.
I agree. On the other hand, it is my role to listen. It is.
Up to a point.
Yeah, I know.
She doesn't call me.
Right. What I learned today is just say, well, why don't you call Tom?
Well, we had that same thing.
I won't do that, by the way.
We had that same thing with Jim Heavey. There were certain members that he would call. Ron was one of them, because Ron was polite up to a point and would listen to him. And there were other people that he would not call. And he was a developer that wanted, you know, all sorts of things, and the city was evil and all that type of stuff, because he wasn't getting what he wanted from staff, which was following council policy and direction on it, because we were all talking about it. But he wasn't getting the answer he wanted from me, so he'd go and vent off to Ron or somebody else and tell him what a devil I was. So, So sometimes, you know, it's good to listen to people, but it also, it breeds upon itself. So you've got to be careful how you handle it.
Right. And, you know, maybe one of the things that you explain to constituents is, you know what,
the manager and the staff implement what was directed by council. There's only so much we can do in a year, or 2 years, or 3 years. And, you know, that's the direction it went, you know. If you feel like it needs to be a higher priority, maybe you can come and talk to council and we can consider it for the next budget cycle or something like that. You know, we have quite a few residents that come to our council meetings on a regular basis about
X,
Y, or Z, and then our council will determine, you know, yep, that doesn't really fit right now, or, well, that's something we can certainly consider in the future, you know, but as a body. You know, so people bring it in to the group, and then the group has heard all the same thing, and then the group has an idea of, well, you know, and we'll get to it farther down, but anyway.
Back to your question, Dean, Mike, I think it would be very appropriate for Dean to be in the process building for the public.
Yeah, I've got no problem. I think it'd be a great resource, and I'd like to be able to tap his skill set.
For sure.
I just made this offer to Mike. Should I have said to other commission members during our meeting, you know, my interest?
I'm certainly comfortable with it.
I think you just have.
I just have. Well, yeah, of course. But, you know, in the future, would that be an appropriate thing for us to acknowledge
if publicly?
Other situations come up during our regular meeting, so that's clear to all the other members?
I think it should go through Mike. You know, if you've got an idea of how you can engage yourself, then he has a chance to evaluate it before it goes to a public meeting.
Yeah.
That would be his recommendation.
Right. I'd agree with that. Yeah. Or else it's going to be really awkward that you offer something that City Commission me, and I've got to say.
Mike's going.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That makes sense.
Okay, so back to roles and responsibilities. It's found on the bottom. You might see it a couple times through the presentation because it's an important one. So uphold and respect the adopted positions of the council. So, you know, when I don't know how your votes typically come down, if you're a 5-0 kind of board or a 4-3 kind of board, or, you know, if it just all depends on the particular issue.
Mainly 5-0 or 4-1.
But
Tom
when you
voted
get
against one just so he could vote against something.
When you get so when you have an adopted position by the council, it's important for the community that you uphold that position, you know, that you don't spend time talking to the media or talking to residents saying, boy, I sure was opposed to that, and boy, that sure is nonsense, or boy, I don't care for that at all. You know, the more appropriate response once the decision is final, I mean, you can have all that discussion up to the voting point that you want. But once that decision is final, we should really sort of adopt a position of, well, this is the direction that the board has adopted. This is where we're going, and so we're going to make the best of this that we, you know, that we can. We're going to do the best job of it that we can. You know, and what I thought or didn't think before, you know, doesn't matter at this point. You know, you don't have to go into all that detail, but I'm just kind of trying to provide a level of guidance, because when you've got some controversial issues going on and then a vote is taken in, you're going in a certain direction, there's already enough consternation out in the community. It doesn't need additional fuel, because it's not going to change what happened. You know?
So if it's a 4-1 fight, so to speak, before, if it's a 4-1 vote, it's over.
It's over.
That's adopted.
If it's a 4-3 vote, it's over. I'm used to 7, not used to 5. Sorry. Yeah.
Once a vote is taken, everybody's on the
everybody
same page.
Everybody should be on the same page. Yeah. You know, and you know, it's not like you have to talk about it a lot if you weren't happy with the outcome. You just sort of refrain from lamenting.
But that is the position of the city.
Yeah,
that's the position of the commission
and the body. Remember, your authority is
a
body,
and
not individual authority. So, yeah, and again, keeping on your council hat versus your resident hat.
Majority.
You know, Okay, so uphold and respect the adopted positions of the council. And that goes, by the way, for the manager and the department heads as well. You know, we've just recently gone through a couple of things in our little community that are probably not particularly popular with staff. And we've had that discussion. That gets over. It's done. That's that. Moving on. New rules. Moving on.
Yeah.
You know, so.
No, we had that issue with the fluoride issue here. I mean, that, I opposed that up until the time the commission voted for it. And the commission voted for it. That's the city policy. That's what we're doing.
Yep.
And department heads, you might have 24 hours to bitch about it internally. And then we're done. We're just going to go implement it and put a happy face on and do the best we can.
Yep. Yeah. So like
that
goes, you know.
Yeah.
So again,
huge.
Staff, department heads, manager, council, it applies across the board.
Yeah.
You know, your team. Okay, so remember, this is just kind of a summary, I think. Act only within the scope of your authority, respect authoritative boundaries, understand that new people on the commission have a learning curve. You know, sometimes people get a little impatient with that. And it's a pretty big learning curve, depending on where you've come from. You know, no surprise attacks on other members or staff in session. That probably goes the same as no surprise propositions. Maybe you want to talk with people a little bit internally, but certainly no surprise attacks on other members or staff. You know, well, I looked into this and XYZ, and here you are in public. It's like, well, wasn't that a conversation we could have had, you know, previous to being in the public. Just say no to special requests. Those are things we'll kind of cover going forward. I did this in a little reverse order, but and then always place the community well-being first. You seem to have a pretty good reputation here for many, many years, a stable, solid community politically. A lot of communities are not that blessed. But opposition costs are extremely high. I don't think people realize that if you've got a business, like just use Shorts for example, if they want to expand somewhere, they're you know, because they recently grew, right, from Bel Air went into Elk Rapids, recently being relative, but you know, there's always industry and businesses, whether they're regional or they're coming from outside the region, who are looking for places to go and places to, you know, set up shop and call home. And depending on the reputation of your community and what it's like to work with the council, and, you know, is this kind of a community that's always at odds with each other, and how long is it going to take me to get the kind of things that I need here in order to get things off the ground? They make their decisions based on their perception of what it's like from place to place. How easy is it for me to accomplish things in this community versus accomplishing something in another community? Your bond rating, part of your bond rating, and I don't know very much about this, but I had a bond attorney tell me this and I was so shocked that I listened. Part of your bond rating is subjective. Most of it is objectively figured out, but some of it is subjective based on, you know, their ability to count on the community to be stable. So that can affect, you know, your bond rating, which is huge. I mean, even dropping it just a little tiny bit is a big expense, you know. So. Anyway, just important to always keep those opposition costs in mind, and again, you know, kind of get on board with the direction of the community as a whole.
I think that's been a real effective tool for Boyne City. I mean, ever since, you know, whether it's a Main Street program or whatever, a lot of state agencies like to work with us,
right?
Because we're not drama queens. Mm-hmm. If they come to us, something gets done. And usually without a whole bunch of headlines or drama or opposition and things like that.
Right.
So they come to us time and time again because we have such a good reputation. So that's something, it's kind of an intangible But it's something I think we really have to make sure we nurture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like one of your one-liners that says, we're the community that likes to say yes.
There you go.
You know, it's...
So then,
those are your words.
Yeah, no.
We've crafted it well.
Here's our reminder that reasonable people often disagree. Oops. So, roles of the mayor.
Ooh,
who's our mayor right now?
Yeah, you? Me.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's going to take a pass right now, right?
I'll be back shortly.
All right. Yeah, maybe we need to take a break, but I think I'm pretty close to the end here. Presides over meetings, maintains order, and assures compliance with the rules. So, example, if you're 5 minute, I think you have a 5 minute rule for public comment. You know, depends on how formal or informal you need to get, depending on the issue. But you're the one that provides the consistent, you know, enforcement or fair enforcement. I should say more fair because mayors generally serve as a voting member, have no veto power, are the ceremonial and political head of the community, facilitate communication among all members. You have to be careful with that though. You know, facilitating communication is one thing, actually.
It's different than controlling.
Round robin is a little bit different. Right, or controlling.
Well, on every issue, I go through a, ask each member for their input.
Well, when you're in a meeting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you're saying that's good?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I mean, they have the right to say, I'm all set, no comment, or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Correct. But also, I think in a little bit larger sphere or two, just to kind of nurture that, you know, yeah, go to the manager with that, or yeah, we should talk about that and maybe bring that to a council meeting kind of thing. You can... can help facilitate that type of a culture. So again, generally no activity in daily operation and upholds and respects adopted positions. So, roles and responsibilities of the manager. Please raise your hand if you have any objections. So, chief administrative officer, generally responsible for community affairs according to your charter. So it is important to know your charter. Keeps you informed of financial condition and all other affairs for which the manager is responsible according to your charter. Implements policies to achieve council goals and reports on progress. So when you want that bathroom, and you say, hey, why don't we have a bathroom yet? He says, well, because the open space in the community building or the government center was our highest priority, and bathrooms are probably next. But we talk about that kind of thing, right? And then up to him to kind of determine how do we get there from the direction from council. Is how are we going to implement that? How are we going to attain that? Responsible for daily operations, including all personnel issues. So again, important if people are whispering in your ear, you need to let Mike know that. And then uphold and respect adopted position counts. I told you I was being a little redundant on that. But yeah, his role as well. Have you read your charter? One of the things that's helpful with your charter and with your ordinances, so I won't have to say it when we get there, is you kind of learn the table of contents. Or have that, you know, extra little copy in your own personal notebook. It kind of lets you know where, it's like, where would I find that? You know, somebody's talking about something, or you're wondering about parking, or couldn't we do something different? I mean, if you have an idea in your head what that table of contents is, you know, you kind of have a better idea where to go look for that stuff. It's I think people get daunted by, boy, I really don't feel like reading all that, and then they don't. So if you just familiarize yourself with that table of contents, it's a big help. Charter is your authoritative structure. We talked about this a little bit earlier, so just
just the same as on a federal level with the Constitution and federal laws. We have a state constitution and state laws, such as Open Meetings Act and FOIA, which we'll talk about shortly. And then your charter, you have your ordinances and resolutions and your rules and policies. And so it's that same structure. And of course, they take precedence in this order, too. If anything's prohibited up here, it can't be down there or there, you know.
Unless it's marijuana.
Well, that is an exception, for sure. Yep.
If that whole screen went up in smoke.
Ha! Yeah, moving on. So, typically local units of government write their own charters, voted on and adopted by the people. Some units of government have a state statute as their charter. The Village of Elk Rapids has the General Law Village Act. That's our charter. And then we create our own ordinances and rules. And again, can't exceed the scope of your authority. So a little bit about daily operations. This is kind of where our conversation was going earlier, so maybe we can just buzz right through this. But so as an elected official, pretend they're the ones asking the question, can I ask a DPW worker to fix a dangerous pothole? No. They've got a schedule that's in place with the manager and their staff. So what you want to do, we'll go to this point that I actually have on my slide. Speaking directly to staff makes them choose between directives. And that's not appropriate to do to the staff member. So you don't want to find yourself in a position where staff members are feeling harassed and confused and not knowing, you know, getting pulled in different directions. So instead you tell the manager, and when he has a solution, he should inform you. Or if you've asked him to inform you, then he should get back to you. Can I poll city employees to know how they feel about a potential change of work hours? No, because personnel is the purview of the manager. You can have a discussion at council level with your manager about, hey, what if we did this with employee hours, but it's not up to you as council members to engage in that conversation with staff. Can the city choose to plow somebody's driveway? Right, somebody's having a tough time, can you help them out?
Like the mayor's?
Or that.
I think it's the newbie.
You should have. Or that. So, no.
Because it's Brad.
But here's what's important.
His plow guy has a red truck. I thought it was the water department.
So here's what's important for people in the community to understand, because sometimes they want to do those sympathetic things for their neighbors, right? Hey, can't you help them out here? I don't understand why you can't do that. You're turning around at the end of their road anyway, right? Why can't you just give them a hand?
The snow at the end of their driveway.
It's like, because it's taxpayer dollars and you provide a public service to everybody on an equitable basis. If you can't do it for everybody, you can't do it for one, basically. If a resident asks me specifically to resolve a problem, we talked about this, can I see it through? Not directly, but you can indirectly, certainly, right? You can go through the manager and you can expect to have an answer. And, you know, again, whether or not they like the answer might be a different story, but you can certainly respond, you know, find a response for them. So ordinances, they are your legislative acts, similar to statutes. Violations can be civil, criminal, or municipal infractions. And it's, you know, helpful to be familiar with your ordinances. And again, you know, I recommend learning the table of contents if you're not going to read the whole book. I don't know how many chapters of ordinances you have.
Of ordinances?
Any idea?
It's about 8 or 9 pounds.
Yeah. The charter isn't that bad.
But the ordinances?
Yeah.
We had somewhere in excess of 64 chapters in our ordinances, and we're actually consolidating them down to 10.
Oh, well, we have more than that.
Like somewhere between 10 and 12, they're being consolidated. But yeah, it was a lot.
So, table of contents. consequences of acting beyond your scope of authority. For councils and officials, there's liability under state and federal law. There's regulatory punishments. If you act beyond the scope of your authority, they can, funds can be withheld, things like that. I'm trying to think of an example. I think we had one community that was actually dumping in a place where they weren't supposed to be, kind of thing. And that may have been a directive from the elected body, and you know, they didn't have the authority to make that decision, and that was a problem. You do have liability, some level of liability for actions and statements when not in session. So careful about that. Again, this is one of those times where it's so hard. When am I wearing which hat, right? Liability for violations of the Open Meetings Act, which we'll talk about, and insurance coverage may be negated for some acts. So if there's, sexual harassment, civil rights violations, those are kind of the obvious ones, but sometimes other intentional violations of acts can negate your insurance. And one of the things that's really important to note is that sometimes what you say or do individually can open up the entire village for a lawsuit. So again, those lines get blurred. You know, you might not face just personal liability. You may face personal liability as well, but you can also bring the whole village into it. Open Meetings Act is an easy one, but there are others, you know, other ways that happens.
So could you give an example of liability for action statements when not in session?
Sure. If you are perhaps slandering somebody who's done business with the city, or you know, have something to say about their reputation and they decide to take action with that. Well, that's one. You know.
And they could bring the whole city in? Or
I'm not an attorney. Okay. You would face some personal liability.
Yeah.
And often, yes, the village can be brought into it as well. You know, I think what attorneys do is they go for the deeper pocket, right? So, I'm going to say. We just talked about a residency issue in another community where if you've got one person that's making statements about that in a way that violates what state law says, if an employee was to file any kind of a suit, would it just be the individual or would it be the village or the city? And very likely that's gonna drag in the whole city, kind of thing, not just be one person. So,
okay.
Yep. Roles and responsibilities, oh, we're very nearly on. Specifically in meetings, these are easy. You adopt your own rules and procedures, such as attendance and absence policies. I'm sure you have those, right?
Yeah.
Some communities don't, so always good to ask. Time and length of public comment. Voting responsibility, this is an interesting one because sometimes you'll find a member that is more comfortable abstaining instead of voting. Well, I didn't have enough information, or I had the information, but I didn't feel like I had the information I wanted, or something, you know, and kind of, there are all kinds of different reasons for abstaining, but an abstention is only required by law if there's financial gain involved. And that's direct financial gain is considered you as an individual or your immediate family. And I believe, but you'd have to check with an attorney, when I last knew it was like $250 or more, something like that. Anything under $250 wasn't considered a financial gain necessarily for legal purposes. There are all kinds of reasons that you might have a conflict of interest. what a lot of communities do is if you feel like you might have a conflict of interest on an upcoming issue or vote, is you would reveal that conflict of interest to the rest of the council. The council would make a decision as a group, as a board, on whether or not that would be considered a conflict or not, and then you would go from there. If you are going to abstain from a vote, or if you have a conflict of interest, you should not participate in discussion.
It's quite a discussion in Charlevoix about that. Is there, along these lines, are there any other rules of procedure for the commission beyond what's stated in the charter?
Do we have any other separate rules or procedures?
We have the rules, yes.
Have we shared that with the entire commission?
Did you get those in your
initial packet,
the rules and regulations? Okay.
Maybe we should make a copy for everybody.
So that's an adopted set of policies.
Yes.
Some time ago.
Yes,
the commission.
2002.
Yeah, so that sort of supplements or elaborates on what's already in the charter.
We can get those for you.
We should get that for everybody.
Yeah.
Just make sure everybody's got it. Mm-hmm.
Access to the attorney. This is something some communities don't think about until it's too late. Should have a policy in place that states who does or doesn't have access to the municipal attorney. Usually it is the manager and the mayor and or the mayor through each other. Or the council as a whole may certainly say, hey, I really think we should ask our municipal attorney about that environmental issue. Don't you, Mike? Michael says, sure, I'd be happy to give them a call and get an opinion back. You know, then you're doing it as a group. But as far as individuals, hey, I want to ask them what their opinion was about what happened the other night because I don't think that was right. Can't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, unless, again, you go through the manager, sees it as something, or the mayor sees this as something that is like, boy, that's probably an opinion that we should have going forward. So I don't know what your policy is, but
the commission voted a number of years ago because we had this issue come up where we had a commissioner that was running to the attorney and the attorney was looking for guidance as to how to respond. So we took this issue to the city commission.
Which is good before you got the bill.
And the city commission basically said all commissioners need to go through the manager, including the mayor, to get to the attorney. So, because our attorney is paid on an hourly basis, it's not a retainer, so every time somebody called him, the meter would start going and he'd be running up a bill and that type of stuff. So either the commission as a group can say, we need to have the attorney here, or somebody needs to go through me, and then I kind of make a judgment call or take it to the commission and say what we need to do. Mm-hmm. When I first came to town here, the attorney went to all of our meetings. You haven't even seen the attorney yet, the two of you, because he comes to almost none of our meetings yet because we weren't getting any value. At least that was the discussion we had at that time, and we just basically stopped him from coming, and we just bring him in on an as-needed basis right now. So if you ever think we need an attorney or need an opinion on something, let me know.
And the problem of having, when we did have an attorney attend the meeting, so too, was they get involved in the deliberation,
yeah.
And it goes off track sometimes. It's like
almost a make-work project, it seemed at times, but
right. You're never hesitant to go to the attorney.
Oh no, heavens no!
Save a couple bucks.
No, no, no.
Who is the attorney?
Plunkett and Cooney.
Oh yeah.
It's a law firm out of Petoskey, and our main attorney is Jim Murray.
Right.
Depending on what the specialty is, like on labor law issues or personnel issues, we would deal with Laura Dynan. You might have just seen her on the front page of the Petoskey News Review talking about the sexual harassment issues. She does a great job on that. And certain other cases, like involving insurance companies, we'll have other attorneys that are assigned through the insurance company that we've worked with before. So it all depends on what the topic is.
Jack Deegan's comp cases, should something
arise. Yep.
I go way back to Steve Barney and Gretchen. So.
Oh, Gretchen Olson.
Yeah.
All right.
Could I ask a question about that financial gain? At what point should you declare that?
$250?
No,
should
you notify someone prior to a meeting?
If you think you have one, I'd encourage you to let me know. Then that might be something I run before the attorney or something of that nature.
Because you wouldn't wait until the time of the voter to issue.
It'd be real messy if we didn't have an answer in advance or if there was confusion on it. It's nice if we know there's an issue coming up or there's some uncertainty. I always encourage people to toss it out and gives the staff the chance, the staff to work on it, so we aren't surprised or something like that, like you talked about before.
And some of them are going to be real clear cut. You'll just say, look, I have a building that's, you know, going to be affected by this decision, and probably all of you know that, but if you don't, now you do, and here it is on our agenda, so I won't be participating in this discussion, and I will abstain from the vote.
When Dan Atkinson used to be on the city commission, and we'd have heating and cooling things that affected his company, he would say, I have a conflict, I believe I have a conflict of interest on that. He would have contacted me in advance, or else it'd be common. You know, we'd know after going through a few of these. And then the commission would say, yes, we agree. They'd vote to allow him to abstain. And then he would get up, leave the table, and leave the room until the discussion is over. It's not that you're just not quiet. You get up and leave. I mean, Jane McKenzie did that when she was the chair of the planning commission, and we had certain issues come up.
Yeah.
You get up and you leave.
She didn't have to resign, but
that's a whole different level.
Now, does the rules of procedure outline those?
I'm going to go grab those now.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We also, on the flip side of that, a few years ago, we had a commissioner that didn't want to vote on controversial issues, right, who would basically say, I've got a conflict of interest on this. Well, what is it? I know so-and-so, or, you know, it was bogus reasons. And the commission would not approve it, so he had to stay in and he had to vote. People have used that as a dodge to get away from a tough decision or a vote they didn't want
to
make.
Right, and that's what I was referring to when I said, is there an abstention policy?
Yeah.
You know.
That's been our practice with regard, whether it's in the policy, but it's the way we've always done it.
Sometimes in policies, too, I guess we see it. There's more than just, of course, financial gain. It could be conflict of interest. It could be a relationship.
Right.
It could be proximity to a property. And
well, not proximity usually isn't in...
Well, it might not be here, but that could be. And sometimes, you know, it is for, like, planning commissions, but maybe not for elected. But the other one is, that was in something, it was about employment. And there was a case related to elected officials where there was the ruling that if you're employed by the company that's seeking some action, then that's an automatic if you're an elected official. That's not the same if you're in the planning commission. Because
we've had the city attorney rule on those types of questions with regards to somebody's associated or affiliated with a company that might be associated or affiliated with some action we're taking.
Yeah.
And there, it wasn't always a clear cut yes or no. It all sometimes it depended on how far removed that employee was.
Right. But anyhow, there's other things other than financial that could be a conflict of interest. That, you know, if we kind of knew what that list was, that would help us decide if we need to start talking about this.
We haven't had much more than financial come up.
Financial is the biggest one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so general responsibilities for meetings is arrive on time, be prepared in a forum. Shouldn't have to say that, but you know what? Some people aren't like that. So it is a responsibility of the elected official to do that. That's your responsibility to the people who elected you. Get recognition of the presiding officer before speaking. I'm going to speak to this just a little bit. This is a passion of mine. I know most smaller size communities tend to like to be more informal. The one danger with that is when you've got some controversial issues, whether it's controversial in the community or controversial among the members of the council, then you know, all of a sudden the presiding officer finds himself enforcing rules that have never been enforced before. And then the person who is perhaps in the opposition is saying, hey, you know, this is unfair. Why all of a sudden am I being treated this way when this is never the way we've functioned before? You know, just because you don't want to hear what I have to say? All of a sudden now you've got this dichotomy that you're dealing with. It's like, oh, well, you know, true enough. Normally we just let discussion free flow, right? So it's not that hard to get in the practice of looking at your presiding officer and waiting for his nod to say, you know, I see you want to speak next and you're after him.
I think, you know, I get the feeling we have that down pretty well.
Tim does a really nice job.
Yeah.
The other night.
Maybe Tom doesn't feel that way.
No. The other night, it became a little less. And after we went to board deliberation, I let Kelsey speak and Ashley speak and Chris Christian speak, which was actually improper. I knew it, but it was pretty informal. It was a small crowd, and it was a pretty non-controversial issue. I mean, that's where I kind of use my judgment to. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, if we have... The bigger the audience or the bigger the issue, I try to be spot on.
Mm-hmm. I think even in that case, you know, you made the call. It wasn't a free-for-all.
Right.
Well, and again...
They raised their hand and I recognized
them. You made the call.
But technically speaking, they should have been allowed to speak.
So, and we're talking a little bit here, I think, about residents, recognizing residents to speak when maybe it wasn't their turn. But, you know, again, as long as council has a good idea of what you do, you know, when you speak through the chair,
right,
and things like that,
right,
then you can help be supportive when he needs to enforce the rules and or when you feel like there's a little more opportunity to be relaxed about it. You know, you as a group can kind of have your own culture that you understand of how that works.
Well, and he passes from one to the next commissioner on each thing so that it doesn't all start in one place even. He spreads it out.
And
so
we get...
alternate who serves.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you'll have residents that, you know, they don't want to stand at the microphone, which... I don't know how your recording system works, or you know,
we don't have that. But,
my room is great, and there you can hear everybody really well.
Okay. But when that doesn't happen, you can often get people who just kind of blurt out from their seat at maybe not the most appropriate times. So the more kind of formality that they see, and it can be a relaxed formality, you know, just kind of a nod to each other up there, who kind of moves next, whatever. The more that residents see that, the more they understand the process of, oh, I probably have to raise my hand and get some recognition, right? I probably can't just blurt it out.
See, like on Tuesday, I wasn't too concerned about going to those people in the audience. Sometimes what I notice more is when you go to a person in the audience, they think, well, then the conversation just continues. They should get re-recognized if they want. They should put their hands back up if they want to have another statement or another question.
Yeah.
Otherwise, a conversation starts taking place that's outside of your control.
I can improve on that, yes. And the big meetings like housing, when you have to give everybody 5 minutes, you know, it's a 4-hour meeting.
Or three.
Just,
you can change your number of minutes
when
you have a big group.
It's just,
it
becomes...
Okay, you had one already?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a long meeting because you have to let everybody speak.
Right.
That's painful.
You can adjust that in order to hear everybody. You know, just so you know. I mean, that's something you can do. No, I guess it depends on your culture as a chair, or if you have it in rules, or if you don't have it in rules, how you do that. But you can go to 2 or 3 minutes, depending on if you... You know, one of the things you can do at the beginning of a meeting is say, how many people are here to speak on such and such agenda topic? And if you've got 40 hands raised, like, okay, you know, we're going to have to go to 2 minutes per person.
Now, can we do that? Because we haven't adopted 5-minute policy.
Well, you might...
Does that go to a vote of the commission, or amend that policy?
Probably have the commission override it for specific meetings like that.
Yeah.
You know,
draft
an amendment that allows an exception for those kinds, you know, so that everybody has an opportunity to speak. And then one very common thing is if you know that you are going to repeat what somebody else has just said, please... You know, out of courtesy and respect for everybody, and, you know, please say, I concur with, you know, Cindy
Joe,
Grice's
right.
comments, and maybe you add a smidge of their own, but it perfectly, you know, if you're all intelligent people, you can all say, yep, we get that, you agree with that person, we don't have to go through the same argument again. You know, you can ask them, if we've already heard the argument, You know, you certainly can stand up and let us know what side you're on, or you can turn in a written comment, or you can turn in a card. This is where I stand on it. But you don't have to repeat what other people have already said. And a lot of people will get that. And some people have anxiety about speaking, so they're just as happy to say, yep, what she said. You know, they feel strongly enough that they're there.
Yeah.
You know,
that
they're willing
effort.
To stand
yeah.
there and hear their voice shake or whatever they have to do to be heard. But they really would, you know, just as soon be able to say, I concur with, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. someone else who previously spoke. And and that helps move things along.
So do those rules apply to every type of meeting or only our formal meetings?
They should apply to.
Well, I can think of an example like that housing summit, which was an opportunity to get interaction of different kinds.
That's, yeah.
So we could. It doesn't mean we have to follow the same set of rules. We could customize our way of interacting to what the nature of the meeting is. Couldn't we?
I'm trying to think if the housing summit was even a city commission meeting.
That was. We didn't bill it as a city meeting of the city commission.
I don't
right?
think
city
so.
Meeting of the city commission.
I mean, all the city commission. The city commission was there, so we took attendance on it.
Right, but yeah, right. So it really applies to the meetings of
yeah,
the.
Yeah, and your standing committees.
Right.
You know, would similarly have. You know, now maybe you don't get a lot of attendance there, and it's just the members. You know, having discussion amongst themselves, it kind of all depends on how it functions in each community.
Like the goal setting sessions, we don't run those as a city commission meeting,
right.
but we do take attendance on those and things of that, just to make sure we're in compliance with the open meetings, but not the same rules apply.
Right. So let's say that meeting, you know, when you couldn't do the public hearing on the special assessment,
yep.
Had to postpone that, but everybody was there and wanted to say something. Could you have structured a meeting a little bit differently, having it more of the folks who were the experts, if you will, up in front making presentations, and audience members being able to ask questions of them, you know, directly upon raising their hand, that sort of thing, as opposed to the more formal way of a certain number of minutes to make your point, and it's all directed toward the front of the room where we are and so on. Is there that flexibility, or should it all be the same more formal structure that we have?
That's a decision of the body. You know, what do you think is going to facilitate what it is you're trying to accomplish? You know,
I still think, I felt that was the best format to run that through, is direct everything through the chair to keep, because that's our normal practice, so
right.
we're not having to figure out which rules apply type
right.
of thing.
Right.
Because there's always, because then Tom or somebody can turn to staff or to Larry Fox in that case or whoever the person is and say, you
sure.
know, can you address that? Or maybe
right.
it's a question that doesn't need to get addressed then, and it's dealt with later.
Right.
Because sometimes the best answer is, we'll get back to you type of thing.
Sure. But I guess my point is, we would have some flexibility. We do have some flexibility how we structure a meeting depending on the
well, I think
what
that's
we're,
a
what
discussion
that night.
Needs to take place internally.
We're not bound by
depending
one
on
thing.
What.
Well, the commission
in
has...
regular commission meetings, you should be. I mean, I'm sorry, I use council.
Yeah, commission interchangeably, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think of the fluoride issue, some of those issues that came about, where we had this outside influence from one from Traverse City and one from Cadillac and one from, I don't know, Sault Ste. Marie or St. Ignace. I don't remember who the parties were or names,
yep.
but they just wanted to take the meeting over.
Mm-hmm.
I had to shut them down.
But the five-minute requirement to speak is not based on residence, so they still have
no.
the right to speak, but only for 5 minutes.
Right, but then we had the ones, a couple of these people wanted to basically take the meeting over, you know, with their so-called, you know, knowledge of fluoride, you know, and all its detrimental attributes and whatever in it.
We have had times where
it got a little bit hairy.
We have had times where we have a packed meeting or something like that, and somebody will hit up to a five-minute rule, and the person will ask, you know, can I have an extension for another minute or two or something like that? And that can be asked by either the person or by the commissioners through the chair, and then the commission has generally voted on it to say, okay, yeah, we'll give you another 2 minutes or something of that nature.
Well,
I think I saw you handle that, but we'll get back to you. Let's hear from everybody else.
To interject that, and that's kind of a common procedure is Everybody gets to speak once, and then we'll see how much time is left when everybody's turn is done. Then we'll see if there's someone who has, you know, would like to finish a comment, if they got cut. We actually, in Elk Rapids not that long ago, we're running a timer, we just ran a timer and you could hear it. We have a little microphone system. It wasn't rude or obnoxious, it was just a little beep. It was just like beep, 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 you know. So, and that would kind of, it would just, yeah, every time somebody spoke, you just press that little button as soon as they started to talk, and when the little beeper went off, and hit it, and they have to wrap up. And
Tom's got his iPhone.
I was thinking about that meeting with Barb, because I couldn't, listen and take in, figure out how much time was left or something, and we'd get down to 30 seconds, and it,
she'd notify
you. Short sometimes.
Well, and one of the things that you can do, because you guys are pretty progressive, is you can, you can do this through the internet. There's a little timer thing. You can just have it on a screen so that the speaker can see it, so they kind of know where they're at. It's not to be rude. It's to be fair for everyone. It's not to be rude to one or two people.
When we get our TVs, that could be a possibility. Cindy's offered to do time for me, but if I have it right in front of me, I'm more focused, so I use my iPhone.
Because you're not always looking at me for, you should be,
Well, that's why we had the beep. That's why we had the audible beep.
I like the beep.
Kind of like, because I can't always catch the eye of our village president, and it wasn't anything awful. It was pretty low key, just kind of like, whoop, time's up, And then again, it was when everybody was done speaking for the first time, it was like, has everybody had a chance to speak for the first time? How many people would like to speak again? And then there was a lot of, then you can judge, well, how much more time do I have?
We have our one or two that want to speak 10 more times.
Well,
and
I thought that on the special assessment, when we come back to a person a fourth or fifth time, I'm thinking, okay, how many times do we need to go back to this person?
Right, but you can make a call on that. A person isn't guaranteed unlimited time, right?
True, but on the other hand, if you give that person every chance, you'd kind of take the wind out of their sail once they've had five or six times. it's kind of, it can go both ways. It can hurt you or it can help you.
Who was that? I don't remember. Was it the older person?
Doran Davis? Or,
yeah.
I think he might have been one of them. It seemed like there were a couple that time.
Frank.
Frank the time before.
Thinking of Frank, too. Frank kind of his public behavior sometimes in a meeting I don't appreciate.
I agree.
I think using the podium is an important thing for just formality, that people need to go to that podium, in meetings like that, to speak. Rather than just thinking they can stand up, he's walking around. I don't think that's appropriate in a public meeting like that. You go to the podium, and that's where you address the community.
That's up to you as a body, but that's what I would espouse.
Helps to control the
just keep it a little bit more formal. People know what's expected. Right. The same with that. How many times do I get to speak? Or something. It's like, man. You get your 5 minutes, or because there's so many of you, you get your 2 minutes, and you're just consistent, because then people learn in the community. It's like, well, I didn't like it, but that was fair.
Well, I can just say that.
Or they learn, like, well, I've got 2 pages here to read. I'm probably not going to get that done. I better highlight what's important and hit that first. And people just learn. And government is supposed to function in an efficient manner.
But democracy doesn't.
As long as you hear them.
Yeah.
Plenty of checks and balances.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on, because, I don't know how I'm going to get done. So, let's see.
Well, just before we jump too far, we have our first podium ever.
Yeah, right.
We just have a podium, so we're not used to using a podium. So I try and set it out for certain occasions. We may have a discussion about that later on as to how formal you want to get with it, or if we want to have it out, and where do we put it, and that type of stuff.
And when to use it, maybe.
Yeah.
And on a side note, I've been complimented many times that we've run a very well meaning, and I'm getting these compliments from maybe people who have been to school board meetings, which can be a comedy act. So.
No, and I would second that. I mean, when we have reporters that go around to all these different boards, I mean, you talk to Steve Zucker or you talk to some of the other press people, they've come and complimented us many times about just how a good, efficient meeting that we run, that it's the right balance between formality and efficiency and, you know, making people comfortable. So
absolutely.
I don't think we're too far off from where we need to be if we have to tweak it at all.
Exactly.
But
I do like the podium. I like that one.
Yeah.
For you have meetings. To be kind of serious about what you want to say if you're going to get up to the podium.
Instead
of just, but you also, but that's a balance of, do you want to intimidate people?
Exactly. Some people may not feel comfortable going to a podium.
We see them. Yeah.
You see these people?
That's Frank.
That kind of
Frank.
Just blurt out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't have too much of that.
No.
But they're there.
You just need it when it gets out of hand. I mean, you need it for those one or two times where
yep.
it could just...
Yeah.
Right, but again, if you don't do it...
Consistently,
then when you do it when it gets out of hand, the individual who...
Has an argument, you're picking on me.
Yeah.
These are new rules.
Like,
but usually those people are just at those meetings when the fire's hot. They're not there...
Well, it depends, Depends on the community, how that goes.
Well,
so,
the voting, try it.
Yeah.
And if it works out well, fine. If it's like, you know, it isn't worth the effort, too intimidating, whatever, we don't have to use it.
Okay, so have basic knowledge of parliamentary procedures adopted by council. You probably all help each other with that. I have a few things to go over, but not a whole lot. And then manager participate. You know, you can get wonderful parliamentary coaching from the league if you are able to do some of their functions. Often they'll do workshop sessions before your event. So if you go to the Capitol Conference or you go are able to go to the convention, they'll have a workshop on parliamentary procedures.
I think we're pretty good. I don't really know. Okay. When I first came to town, we used the parliamentary procedure a lot. Sometimes it seems like it got more in the way than anything else. But I think we got the right. I feel we got the right balance. We've got enough parliamentary procedure and routines that. You know, nobody feels like they're being treated unfair or we're making things up, and we know the procedures to go through if we need to.
Yeah, and the other night, we were making motions that we maybe wanted to do an amendment.
Amendment to the motion.
You coached us.
Yes.
And we got through that just fine.
Yeah, I was trying to simplify the process and I complicated it, but yeah.
You know, it worked well, and we were able to figure it out, with your help, exactly what to do, but not that many.
All right, here we go. I gotta move along or we're not gonna get done. I have exercises for you and I have Open Meetings Act and Freedom of Information Act to go over. I won't spend much time on Freedom of Information Act, but we have to get done or I won't get your exercises to you and we won't get finished. So, important function, responsibilities of the presiding officer. We're gonna provide you with support here. It is an important function because it affects the productivity and the tone of the meetings. You know, can't be a bully and you can't be a doormat. You know, it is an important function to have the right balance as the presiding officer. Acknowledge members wishing to speak in order unless a member has conceded position. So you try and keep your eye out to see who wants to speak next and you try and get them in order unless somebody says, no, that's okay. I think I'll let Rob speak first or whatever. Be courteous to members of the council and the public. Enforce rules fairly. We've talked about this. You guys have had a lot of discussion as we go through, so we've covered a lot of this. Enforce fairly the public comment portion of the meetings and tolerate no incivility. Right. So you should all be on the same page with that. You know, if somebody starts to get out of hand, it's everybody be supportive. It's like, oh, no, we don't do that here. You know.
On that. Enbridge Pipeline 5, the two adversarial groups, they start going at it. Whoa, time out.
Yeah, this isn't your meeting, this is our meeting.
Exactly.
And it's not, our meetings are not debate forums. You may come and comment to us for our consideration. That's all you're here for, right? You're there to hear their comment, and you don't have to comment back. But for them to go at it with each other, it's like, no, not a debate forum. It's
right.
A council meeting. We're here to hear you, not you to hear each other. So yeah. So public comment to that. This comes up commonly. If a question from the public may simply be answered, go ahead and answer it. If it's a quick answer, like, when's that darn leaf pickup ever going to happen? You know, because what? The leaves didn't fall until the snow came, right? So is anybody going to come pick up our leaves or not? Kind of thing. You probably have an answer for that, or if your DPW director is there, he has an answer, or Mike has an answer. Like, yes, we intend to do that next week, unless we get another blizzard, you know, kind of thing. Poor example, because once you've plowed, it's probably all back up in your yard, but you understand what I'm getting at.
An administrative answer, just a quick question, yep.
Yeah, or, you know, I'll have Mike get back with you on that. You know, I mean, Mike, can you do that?
No.
Yeah, you know, and then you move on. But you're under no obligation to respond to questions, because sometimes people will bully you into that. Well, I want to know what you're going to do about it. Thank you.
Tom's pretty good at that. I mean, he'll use that tool, you know, as appropriate. If I think I have a quick answer, I'll sometimes raise my hand and say, okay, let's just get it done right now.
Yeah.
Or there's somebody that comes up and wants to pick a fight, and sometimes Tom will shut them right down and just say, thank you for your comments, and he doesn't know what to do with it after he says, tells him that.
Well, I know what you're
I'm fixed, you do what?
They were critical of Mike. He's like, we're not here to discuss that. I just said, so noted, next.
I have actually been at, this goes back some years, I was actually at a city council meeting where a bunch of township members attended to ask the city to fire the manager. I just happened to be there, you know. And, that's why sometimes it's important, you know, with your public comment, listen to people from other communities, but it's important to know where they're from, especially if it's your appropriation process. Because sometimes something expensive, like a skate park, you know, you need to know who's actually wanting the skate park. The people in your community or the people outside your community, and who's paying for it, you know. So those, it is important to know, well, who's actually bringing us this?
Okay, here's a good question then. So, well, I think I know the answer, but back to the Housing Commission, probably 70% of the speakers live in the township, adjacent piece of property, but it was township. You have to let them speak, right? I let them speak, but in my own mind, you guys got zero credibility. I'm not making a decision for the betterment of the township.
If you really didn't want them to, you know, I guess you'd have to ask the attorney about that, because I don't have I'm not on solid ground to give you an answer on that.
I think you'd almost have to let them speak.
Actually, it'd be nice for me to speak just by virtue of their residence.
Well, it's the same as the fluoride. They were from out of town, but they had the right to speak.
But then that gets back to her point about, you know, where are you from? Then they say they're from Traverse City or Livonia or things of that
nature.
They
don't have to give you an address, but they do have to identify themselves. You know, so.
We ask for both. If they give us both, that's something
right.
else.
Yeah.
Right.
We do too.
Most places do.
But if they're, you know, resident or non-resident.
That's up to the commissioners then to weigh the source of the information and assign it whatever value you think is appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking about the meeting where we got ganged up on this Proposition 26. I think that's what it was, Proposition 26.
21.
Agenda 21.
Or 21.
Oh, yeah, Agenda 21. Yeah.
That could have turned into a Donnybrook. I mean, it was.
Okay, so.
It was one of those thank you answers.
Yeah.
A word about motions, and we've kind of gone over this. You have your own style. Motions bring a matter before the council. You kind of do things, maybe discussion first. That's not what parliamentarians advise. Motions bring a matter before the council. Seconding a motion does not mean that you favor it. It just means that you think it's valid for discussion. You can even oppose it, but want to have it discussed, right?
And so, that's, but you could either make or second the motion and have that apply, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But the maker of a motion can't withdraw a motion.
But they could vote against it.
They could vote against the motion.
Yeah, well, you want to bring it to a vote.
I did that. Planning Commission wants just to get things moving.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's my understanding.
And then I don't know if you use the terminology seconding or support. We always recommend seconding is the language that
we use.
To second a motion. Because when people start using the term support, it's
okay.
Confused.
Gotcha. Sounds like a support. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the presiding officer does not make motions. You could if you felt really strongly about something and you wanted it to be on the record as kind of your thing. You can actually appoint a temporary presiding officer, and then you can make the motion.
Really?
That happens really rarely. I saw in the legislature once, the Senator Schwartz is a doctor, and there was something that went through that was medically related, and he was very passionate about, and so he happened that day to be the presiding officer, which doesn't always happen. So he stepped down and appointed someone else so that he could actually make the motion and be on the record.
So one thing I've noticed that we do when we go from person to person, we have the discussion kind of before a motion. Sometimes is that individual members will also state their support at that time. Would it be better to, if we like having that discussion, which goes pretty good, just to have the discussion, but wait until there's a motion before venturing an opinion about it?
Well, I would tell you should do your motion first. But, you know, what works for your community works for your community. It will vary a lot depending on the makeup of your council or your board from year to year, how that works, you know. We've got a pretty good handle on starting with a motion now in Elk Rapids, and then we'll amend it or withdraw it or, you know, after discussion we'll say, okay, so what do we need to do with that? You know, what was our original motion? Do we need to withdraw it? Do we need to amend it? What do we need to do before we vote? And but I will say, there's been a little bit of confusion once in a while about, well, did we make a motion just to discuss it, or did we actually make a motion on the item? And it's a motion on the item. It's just that the motion that was stated for the record was, for discussion. So then it was like, what the person actually meant was, let's get this motion out here so we can discuss it. But then later it was taken as, oh, that was just a motion on discussion. We don't actually really have a motion on the... So that was a little bit awkward. That happens on occasion.
So how do you get to the point that a motion is made? You have a staff report and a recommendation, then it goes to the commission or council, and then somebody immediately makes a motion to accept it.
The chair will say, can I have a motion? You know, and there will be, from what I understand how you run your meetings, is there's a recommendation that goes with your agenda item.
Correct.
Can I have a motion? So somebody will make the motion, you know, I move that we adopt resolution 1735. Is there a second? You get the second. Then you discuss, and if you decide, well, we like resolution 1735 except for that second paragraph, you can, you know, amend the motion or withdraw it and start over.
And we kind of do all that, and we've discussed this before, and we've discussed, because she's gone through the same process at our earlier, a couple of years ago, presentations. I mean, you can do it either way. I agree with Tom. I think the way we have works fine, because then we have all the discussion. Somebody can make a motion, and then you kind of amend it as you go or change it to reflect based on what you're hearing at the discussion, what you think you want to do. So we don't have all these amendments usually that take place. But then there's also an opportunity, is there any further discussion with regards to it?
After we have a second, I'd go, is there any further discussion?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you can have further debate on the motion, and then we vote. So, I mean, it's up to the commission, but...
The support thing, because we're expressing support for a motion that hasn't been made.
Yeah, but you really don't know what the final motion might be.
No, you don't.
But, you know, parliamentarians will tell you, professional parliamentarians will say, none of that discussion counts unless you had a motion in front of you.
Well, so because the idea is that...
Nothing counts until the motion or the resolution's made. I mean, that's the that's the action item.
So, you know, if it works for you, it works for you. Again, it kind of depends on the makeup of the commission and...
When we go into commission discussion, this is before a motion, that's when the five commissioners can have a chance to ask the presentation any questions and details. Mm-hmm. And we do it quite thoroughly. You know, mm-hmm. The police department wanted new tasers. So first person said, okay, explain why, how often. And then the motion makes sense because we've already discussed it.
And sometimes, too, you know, if it's clear cut and there's really not much to discuss because it's obvious, and you can say, I support the recommendation, you know, right. And it's...
Support the recommendation.
Move on to the next person if they have something to say about it.
Okay, word about minutes. Minutes are required for council meetings. You probably all know that. It's a preferred method of minutes, and I don't know how you do yours here. Reflects actions only as much as practical. So
if it's a big deal, I put the discussion in there. Yeah.
Sometimes you need a little summary of discussion. Different communities have different styles and different ways of doing it. If you take any training, and if you go to the clerk's training and you go to parliamentary procedure training, they will tell you action minutes are what you need for the historical record. That how you got there doesn't really matter. Who made the motion, who seconded the motion, the vote, and the action is what you need to have in your minutes for that item.
That's for us, not necessarily true for planning commissions and so on. They need findings of fact, and they need other stuff to support their administrative decision.
Closed meeting minutes are available through the clerk, but only under certain legal circumstances. So you'll never see your closed minute meetings. There are some communities, I think, who open them up after a year, 2 years or something, but I only heard about that like a year ago, and all the years that I've worked for the league and stuff, that's not a very common practice.
Yeah.
And I actually don't see the point. So.
To open them up after a certain period of time?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're through records, retention,
yeah.
They should be shredded and destroyed, so yeah. Yeah. I'm not really sure why you would keep going. If there's you know, legal circumstances, then you don't have a choice, but that's, anyway. And then there's the parliamentary mantra, which we'll just skip, because you guys feel strongly. Final questions, I think we discussed it to pieces. I have a couple exercises here, actually it's three. I don't think we'll get to all three of them. I'll pass them around to you, now is probably a good time for you to take a break, or maybe eat what you want to do, which would be more efficient. There's three different exercises here. One is on roles and responsibility. It would kind of give us, if you fill it out, you don't have to put your name on it, but if you give it back to me, I will, over the course of a couple weeks, kind of tally it up and see if you're all pretty much on the same page or not, and then just provide that information back to you. Just kind of like, it's easy stuff. Like, who's responsible for orienting newly elected officials? Is that the elected official's job, the manager's job, the staff job, or an advisory committee job? And it, you know, again, this is mostly for new people, but it kind of helps us get an overview of, is everybody on the same page about what the different roles are for different functions? So I can pass that around, and you can fill it out. We can either talk about it, or we can, you can hand it in, and then when I provide results to Mike, he can let you know what they are, and then maybe you talk about it then. I have another one that is
Clarifying expectations of the manager. This one's always pretty good. It is not how do we rate our manager, just to make that clear. It's clarifying expectations. And what you do in this exercise is the following items are mentioned frequently by elected officials as key expectations of the chief administrator. Rate each on a scale from 1, not important, to 5, very important. And so by getting that feedback back, kind of gives Mike an idea of where you value. There are 25 items on here. And as you're probably aware, a manager has to have skill sets in a number of different areas. But can't be perfect in all of them and can't really make every single one a 5, right? So this is kind of important feedback for us as a group to know, you know, what do we tell him when times are tough and resources are limited time-wise, what do we expect from him?
You know, our manager just can't do everything?
No.
Well, we
better get,
if you get
a new manager.
Well, that brings up a question. You want me to ask it now, or you want to keep going?
You can ask it now, sure.
So we give Mike a yearly evaluation, or maybe every other year. But the evaluation process just ended, and then two people were gone. So our two new members, rightfully so, will start their evaluation and evaluate Mike throughout the year. But if there's some expectations from last year's evaluation, good or bad, how do we hold Mike accountable to those, but not make our new members feel obligated to those conclusions that past members made? So is that well said? Did I state that right?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
Or is it a non-issue? It's kind of tough.
Yeah, I mean, without knowing any specifics, and without putting Mike on the spot.
Well, exactly. It's kind of delicate.
You know, so say you've got one, say maybe a performance goal is, could you please find a better balance in providing us with information? It sort of seems like sometimes we have too much, and it sort of seems like sometimes we have too little. You know, so you check back in 6 months or a year, I don't know what your process is and how that works. And, you know, it's like, well, how are you feeling now? Too much, too little? Is it better? You know, I've made these adjustments. Have you noticed? Has it made a difference? Kind of thing. So I don't think it really matters if there are new members that are
But they
there.
Don't have the perspective of last year's evaluation.
No, they don't.
Observation.
Would it be appropriate to share? Was there a written something summary?
Yeah, there was. So I don't know, Mike, should they be privy to last year's
really
evaluation?
I can't really speak to that.
Yeah, you know? I've kind of struggled with that.
You know, I think it would be helpful, certainly for me as a new person. I certainly would feel that I need to support whatever conclusions are made because I wouldn't have enough experience to.
Or at least know what the issues are, so they can.
So
you can be having. You can be kind of keeping an eye out for them and saying, okay, right. You can draw your conclusions one way or the other. Then
it's still a confidential document, right?
Yeah, but it's. Yeah, I guess that's fair because it's not a document that you had a hand in formulating. But you have a hand in enforcing, so it's
or observing
and in formulating the next one.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The next one's not an issue, but these every other year situations.
Yeah.
It's every year, isn't it?
It's pretty much every year.
Every other year, a new potentially new city commissioner.
Yeah. Okay.
Who wouldn't get it in the process?
Right.
Yeah.
So you're comfortable with them seeing your evaluation?
Oh, sure.
So they have a basis.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. Does that solve it?
Yeah. Okay. I just have to get it to them. Okay. Or have you come in and take a look at it at some point. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So let's do this. And then I have another exercise here that's called taking stuff.
So at some point we're going to decide which of any of these things we're going
to
do.
We are.
What do we have really yet to talk about?
Open Meetings Act, and you know, I can just give you the handouts for Freedom of Information Act and talk about the one or two things that you need to be aware of for Freedom of Information Act, because it's a big, long, complicated topic, and typically you have staff that deals with that. Mm-hmm. There are a couple things you need to know to protect yourselves, you know. But
I had familiarity with it from my job that I
previous
had.
Life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would it be possible to go through that stuff and then we can make a decision about the exercises?
Sure. Is that how you want to do it?
I would like a break, though.
Maybe we should take a quick break. Anybody? Nobody?
Yeah,
I
sure.
can't believe you're in
sure.
a... Just keep rolling with me here. Yeah. Okay. If you want to.
Sun's coming up.
Tomorrow.
It's burning through the clouds right over here.
What? The sun.
Wink effect is so yeah. cool.
There's no building burning. That's okay.
Okay.
The big thing that's hard on open meetings, or not open meetings, is that the